WrestleMania 35. Surely there is a main event that could happen, you and The Miz. And keeping in mind, this story dates back all the way to the original NXT. Mm-hmm. You were The Miz's rookie, hilariously.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there is such an potentially the greatest story WWE has ever told over a long period of time. Imagine that video package going into a main event match at WrestleMania. Is that something you're up for?
I am definitely up for it. My question, you asked me that question. I will answer it with a question.
Oh,
do you trust WWE with telling that story from now until WrestleMania 35? like, what in the last several years has shown to you that something like that is possible here, and for it to be
okay? I will reply to that question. My answer is, the last time they did that successfully over a long period of time was you in the build-up to WrestleMania 30. So if you're involved, you're the key ingredient here.
Yeah,
surely.
If something accidentally happens. And
if they've got no control over it, then
they've got no control
well.
Over it, it's possible that it can happen.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
My client.
Mama Monster.
Conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me.
Delete. You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Well, that was refreshing and depressing all at the same time to hear that. Daniel Bryan is all of us talking about WWE creative. Shout out to the Gorilla Position podcast for that clip. You could check out their full interview with Brian on their YouTube channel. They sat down with him on the most recent WWE European tour, and the thing that I think separates someone like Daniel Bryan from everybody else on the roster, and why one of the reasons why I think he is so well liked, is how honest he is, and how honest in his book, which, you know, I had finally started but didn't finish, but whether it's in his book, whether he's doing interviews like this, there's a certain sort of raw honesty that comes across in everything he said. Now, possibly that's to his detriment, although I think he's at a point now in his career where, frankly, he doesn't care, especially now if he hasn't re-signed with the company yet. It's like, what are they going to do to him? But he just doesn't care. You know, people ask him a question, he'll either answer it or he won't, but I never, ever get the sense that he's bullshitting you when he's answering questions like that. He just says what's on his mind, and in that clip there, he flat out says that he would love to have a WrestleMania match with The Miz, which is something that, you know, I've been pitching on this show for months now, going back to when I had picked Miz to be my pick for the Money in the Bank winner back in January. So he would love it. He would love to get in there with Miz and pick up their feud and have a big WrestleMania match, but you heard it there. He basically does not know if WWE creative can be trusted enough to handle a story like that in the right way. And this is one of their top stars saying this. This is not a podcaster. This is not a dirt sheet. Right? This is somebody who's in the trenches, who's working for the company, working in the back with the writers and the producers, and he does not have enough faith in WWE creative to think that they could pull off, you know, the right ending or the right story with him and Miz going into WrestleMania. And, you know, he even joked there at the end, the only reason that he had the night at WrestleMania 30 that he had and that big moment at the end of the show was because other things had to go wrong, right? In order for them to do the right thing and tell the story that they told of him winning the championship that night in New Orleans. So, you know, between Batista's return that year turning to shit and the fans turned on him and CM Punk walking out when he did, that's the only reason he got the moment he did. And people used to get mad at me for saying that because, you know, in the end, they did the right thing. You gotta give them credit. They did the right thing. And I would say, yeah, I do give them credit. Technically, they didn't have to do anything. They could have still sort of, you know, dug their heels in the ground and did something else. So yeah, in the end, they did the right thing, and I give them credit for that. But, you know, I would always say they had to be dragged kicking and screaming to tell what should have been the most obvious story, right? That should have been a gimme from the beginning. So I think Brian is absolutely right to have his doubts and have his reservations about whether or not WWE can be trusted to properly tell that story or finish that story in the right way between Brian and Miz going into WrestleMania. Now, I would like to see them try. Maybe they screw it up, but I would like to see them try. Because I do still think that's a WrestleMania-worthy match. And I think it's a WrestleMania-worthy match for the WWE title. So, that's my opinion on that. Happy Bobby Bonilla Day, everybody. This is Sunday, July 1st, 2018. This is episode 553 of the Solomonster Sounds Off here. I am the Solomonster. If you are a Mets fan, and if you are, then we can commiserate together. But if you are a Mets fan, the Mets are so god-awful, if I may say so, by the way. It is so frustrating. They'll go on these little hot streaks, and then they'll sort of punch you in the gut and remind you about why... they say you gotta believe why you should not believe. But if you are a Mets fan, you are well aware that today is Bobby Bonilla Day. Now, Bobby Bonilla, for those who don't know, is a player. He had two stints with the Mets in the 90s. He was a massive disappointment. Although sandwiched in between his two stints with the Mets, he was part of that 1997 Marlins team that did win the World Series. But with the Mets, he was, you know, he was no great shakes. So they got rid of him. They said, look, we owe all this money to this guy, but he's not performing up to our expectations. We want to get rid of him. And because at the time he was still owed almost $6 million on his contract, they went to Bobby Bonilla and they asked him if he would be willing to defer the remaining money that he was owed to be paid at a later date. So that what they could do is they can, instead of paying him at that time, they could take that money, however many million, it was like $3 million, I think, that he would have still been owed. They could take that money and they could actually use it to improve their team, which they did. The Mets actually went to the World Series in 2000. They had some good teams there. And so that was their logic in asking for that. And so the agreement that they came to is that they would defer payment to this guy for an entire decade. And then what they would do is they would pay him over $1 million a year at an 8% interest rate from the year 2011 all the way through to the year 2035. So basically, he turned, well, I guess it would have been $6 million into about $30 million, which is in the end what he's going to end up being paid. That's not a bad deal if you're Bobby Bonilla. For the Mets, it may not be such a great deal. They're the ones cutting a check to this guy every year to basically play golf in his tidy whities. But all the Mets fans all across the country, they're well aware of Bobby Bonilla Day. And we all sort of celebrate this day and celebrate the, I guess the, shall we say, what, the intellect of... Because Bobby Bonilla, he knew. He didn't have any reservations. He was like, yeah, let's do a deferred money deal. And he's sitting pretty these days. So good for him. Not so good for the Mets. I must have done something really bad about, or said something really bad about Papa Shango for him to put the curse on me that he has with the year I've had so far. This week I come home and the passenger side of my door is missing the side view mirror, taken clean off. Dented door, paint is all messed up, busted fender. Not a good week. But then I hear about that Matt Capitelli story. And it just makes me feel like shit, you know? It kind of makes you feel like shit for even complaining about stuff like that. Kind of, I don't know, makes you think. I'm going to talk about Matt here in a minute, but I was blessed with some really good wrestling this week, right? That's always a plus for somebody who does a wrestling podcast. We had an excellent main event on Raw. Seth Rollins and Dolph Ziggler, they went almost half an hour. We had an excellent six-man tag this week on NXT. We had the United Kingdom special on the network, which I'm going to review here in a second. That had a bunch of fun matches, especially really great matches on night two. We had the three-way to the grave match on Lucha Underground. And that's not even counting the Ring of Honor pay-per-view, which I haven't had a chance to see. But point is, a lot of good stuff this week. Dalton Castle, bad back and all, he retained his Ring of Honor world title on Friday night. And this next bit here is a spoiler, so if you're not into Ring of Honor or spoilers, you should probably skip ahead here. But the very next night, Ring of Honor had television tapings, and at those tapings, Jay Lethal regained the Ring of Honor world title. He beat Dalton Castle, Cody, and Matt Taven in a four-way. So that makes two failed attempts for Cody now, back-to-back nights, in trying to win back the Ring of Honor world title. So it looks like there will be no champion versus champion match with Cody and Nick Aldis at All in September. Although there is plenty of time between now and then, so I guess you never know. Pro Wrestling Tees is having a summer sale this week, their annual summer sale. It starts tomorrow, Monday, July 2nd at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. It runs straight on through Friday, July 6th, also at 1 p.m. Eastern. You can use the coupon code AMERICA, not to be confused with MERCA. AMERICA is the coupon code. Use that at checkout. Get yourself 20% off all shirts in our Solomonster Sounds Off shop on there, prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. It's very easy to remember. Also, any order in our store, $75 or more. So that would be, what would that be? If you order 4 shirts or more, you will get 1 free wrestling collectible thrown into your order. And any order that is placed on day 1 tomorrow, that's any order placed on day 1 tomorrow on Monday, you'll also get a free 8x10 randomly signed wrestler photo. So go to prowrestlingtees.com/Solomonster Sounds Off. Get yourself some Sound Off gear. Audible, you guys are killing it on there. So keep using our link, audibletrial.com/Solomonster. A lot of you have been cashing in on your free wrestling books. Some of you did the Bob Holly book this week, and I know really liked it. I mentioned Daniel Bryan a little while ago. Brutally honest, his book is on there, narrated in part by Bryan himself. So use our Audible link to sign up for a trial, and you can cash in 1 free book you get to keep no matter what. Thank you to everybody who made a PayPal donation this week in support of the show. You can do so on thesolomonster.com, right-hand side of the page. $10 or more will get you a wrestling nickname and a shout-out. Speaking of which, I got to give a shout-out to Dom, who made a very nice gesture this week, an awfully nice gesture. I love doing this show because of people like him. I had the chance to meet him and his son at our meetup last year, so really good guy. I want to just shout him out up top here. Also say thank you to John Luis Cannon Lopez for his support, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Raymond the Mountie Medina, Doomsday Donde Page, there's a name I haven't heard in a while, hopefully Donde's been okay, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, The Show Off Corey Van Dam, Aim for the Head Andrew Jorlog, The Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Too Bad Trey Marquis, who is celebrating a birthday today, so this is, consider this my gift to you. Hopefully you have a great birthday. The Chicago Slayer Willie Eicher, the Renton Road Warrior Taylor Schatt, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Reno Renegade Wayne Ashanti, Texas Hangman Michael Hanna, Dan the Man Larson, the Orlando Commando Christopher Thompson, and the Sibling Psychos, the Bakersfield Brawler Kevin Velotto, and Max the Axe Velotto. Thank you to everybody who made a donation this week. Last week, I led off the show with news on the death of Big Van Vader. Unfortunately, there was another death in the wrestling world this past week, the death of Matt Capitelli at age 38. Passed away after his second battle with brain cancer. His wife, Lindsay, confirmed the news in a post on her Facebook page. Capitelli, he was one of the winners from season 3 of Tough Enough back when the show was still on MTV. It was actually him and John Hennigan was the other winner, Johnny Mundo from Lucha Underground. And, you know, people think about that Tough Enough season, they think of Matt Capitelli, and they think of that infamous incident with Bob Holly. Bob was brought in, I think he was only brought in for the one episode. And, you know, he was in the ring with Matt, and he stiffed him, and he beat him up, and he bloodied his lip, and he just really kicked the crap out of him. Now, Bob, he gave his side of that whole story in his book. He also talked about it on my show when I had him on the Sound Off a few years ago. Still maybe the best interview I've ever done with a wrestler. And I asked him about that, and we went into it, and he gave his side of the story. I don't really think this is the time or place. I've already talked about this before anyway, but he did make some appearances. Matt did on WWE television. He and Hennigan even had a match on Raw right after they won that season of Tough Enough, and Tommy Dreamer came out and, you know, beat the hell out of him with a kendo stick, hit him both in the head. But he spent most of his time down in OVW. He had a lot of success down there. He became OVW heavyweight champion. Paul Heyman was also writing television for OVW around that time that Capitelli was on top there, so to speak. I can remember reading about some of the really hot angles that Heyman booked involving Matt, and I think it was Johnny Jeter, I believe. Some just really intense stuff, and people were raving about it and how realistic it was, and Heyman didn't have a terribly long run as the head writer, I think, is what his position was down there in OVW, but apparently he left quite the impression for the time that he was, and Matt was definitely part of that. But he was actually about to be called up to the main roster as a tag team with The Miz. They were going to come up as a tag team on TV called Reality Check. Miz talked about it on his Instagram. They were going to come up together, and then Miz got a call from Matt saying that he had brain cancer. He was diagnosed with brain cancer, and that obviously changed plans. And what happened is that he suffered a really bad concussion. And so he had been injured. I think he maybe had a broken ankle. He had come back, and sometime right after he had come back is when he got hit right in the back of the head. I mean, he suffered a blow to the head from Brian Cage at an OVW show. And I'm not sure if that's the same Brian Cage that's now in Lucha Underground. It could be a different one. I just don't know. But I do know that he got nailed really hard, knocked him out legit. He took a face plant on the mat. It was very scary. You can actually find the footage if you look around for it online. And it turned out to be a blessing in disguise, because when he went to the hospital, they discovered that he had a small brain tumor. He probably never would have known until it was really too late, and maybe they wouldn't have been able to do anything for him. But I guess he was not really symptomatic, or maybe if he was, he just wasn't putting two and two together. And only because he suffered the concussion and got hit in the back of the head did he even go to the hospital and find out that he had a brain tumor. So he had to, you know, surrender the OVW title. He came out. He gave this great emotional speech, which somebody just re-uploaded online the other day. It's about 12, 15 minutes long. It's Matt in the ring. All the other wrestlers are surrounding the ring. It's pretty heavy stuff. And, you know, he just talked about how I got to do what I got to do now. I have to get better. I have to, you know, step away from the ring and undergo treatment and figure out what my plan is. And he went into remission the following year in 2007. He went into remission. He was in remission for a decade before the brain cancer came back. This time, though, it was diagnosed as a grade 4 glioblastoma, which is just, it's the deadliest form of brain cancer that there is. Glioblastoma is a death sentence. Only 5% of people diagnosed with it survive another 5 years. I mean, there's been some, you know, notable political figures. I think Ted Kennedy had a glioblastoma. John McCain right now, he has a grade 4 glioblastoma. I know my boss at work was telling me once about a family member who was diagnosed with a brain tumor. Turned out to be glioblastoma. I don't even know if they lasted a year. So it's a particularly vile, nasty form of cancer. Not that any form of cancer isn't nasty and vile and disgusting and should be eradicated from the earth. But this one is pretty much one of the worst. And he had surgery. They were only able to get 90% of the tumor removed. His wife posted a blog in May, only a couple of months ago, not even, saying that they were in consultation with his doctors. They had decided that they were going to discontinue his treatments because they just weren't working anymore. And, you know, when you're that sick and you're terminal, you get to a point where it is more important to make sure that the person is as comfortable as possible. They call it palliative care, because you just get to a point where, frankly, it's almost inhumane to continue treating something that is untreatable. And anybody who has had any sort of serious illness, anybody that has had to deal with cancer, or has had a family member or a friend or somebody they know go through whatever type of cancer it is and go through radiation and chemo and all that treatment, you know, as well as I do and as well as anybody else does, that a lot of the time, the real bad stuff doesn't even come so much from the cancer or the tumor. It comes from the treatment. The treatment beats the hell out of you and makes you sicker and sicker. And it's just a game. It's like a game that you play, right? You're definitely, I mean, I hate to call it a game, but it's not a game per se, but it's almost like you're just taking a gamble here. You know, you want to get better, you want to feel better, you want to live, and so you do what you feel you need to do. But sometimes you got to weigh your options and say, look at, you know, what kind of life am I going to live if they're telling me that it's only going to do so much, but it's going to make me so much sicker. So like when I went and read that blog post, and it just struck a chord with me, because, you know, in my family, I've had a lot of experience dealing with this sort of thing, and it's so true. It's not an easy decision to make, but you just get to that point where you gotta make it. You gotta make the tough choices. And you know, I can't imagine what that whole family has been through, everything that Matt had to go through. You read his story and it's almost angering, it's depressing, it's very sad, it makes you very very frustrated. You know, why does something like that have to happen? There really is no answer. Now, I don't know, you know, in the end with Matt, he was clearly somebody, the thing that struck me about him is, you know, you hear nothing but positive stories from people in wrestling who knew him or who worked with him in OVW, who met him. I haven't heard one person say one bad word about this guy. Not one. And it's very likely that he would have gone on to become a very big star in the business. You can never know. You can never be sure. Maybe he would have suffered some other kind of injury, but he was primed to be a very big star in wrestling. He had enough talent. He was young enough. He was all but guaranteed to be a big name right now, had he not gotten sick. And the thing about him that strikes me, you read all these stories now, and I would periodically read stories about him over the years, the local news, I think in Louisville would do some news segments and follow him around, and you can see how much he had deteriorated, but he was still, you know, being active and working out, and he was a trainer, I think, over at OVW, and the thing about him that really struck me was just his positive attitude. I know he relied a lot on his faith. He was a very, you know, religious person, and that had a lot to do with it. But he was just a very positive person throughout this entire ordeal, going back to 2006, I guess it would have been, when he was first diagnosed. Any interview I ever saw this guy give, he was always trying to look at the positive side of things, no matter how terrifying the news was. And he knew, all right, I'm going to have brain surgery, and I'm going to have to go through this, and I'm going to have to go through that, and basically give up my entire life. And this guy was keeping a positive outlook on everything, and it's not easy to do. It is not an easy thing to do, you know, seeing what cancer can do to somebody. It's very, very hard to keep a positive attitude, and I just don't see how you can read up on this guy's story and watch him and not look at him as some kind of an inspiration. You know, he's braver than I think a lot of people would be. I think he's a hell of a lot braver than I would be if I ever found myself in that same situation. And so I think people can look to this person here as an example, and I hope none of you ever have to go through the hell that he did, but you look at him as an example of how to deal with a situation like that, right? You deal with it head on. You don't pull the whole woe is me, why me. It's very easy to do that. I think we all do that sometimes. And this guy didn't do that. And I think it's very unfair what happened to him. But for a guy who never got his big break in the wrestling business, you look at the outpouring of tweets and messages from wrestlers inside and outside WWE. Announcers, wrestlers, you know, promoters, everybody had something to say about Matt Capitelli this week. And you look at that and you say, man, you know, for a guy that never, quote, made it to the main roster and never made it to prime time, he sure did leave an impression on an awful lot of people. And he gave this quote to WWE.com. They did an interview with him last year. And I think this sums him up pretty well. This is what he said. This was his message to others. He said, "You have to fight for what you want. Life is the most precious gift that we're given. If I can inspire others to not give up on the life they've been blessed to have, that's what I'm trying to spread. Hope. It's not time to crawl up in a hole and feel bad for myself and get down. It's time for me to stand up and share my struggles publicly so that others can draw strength and hope from me. That way, I'm giving back and turning what I've been given in life into a positive and helping somebody along the way." And I think that if ever there was somebody who deserved that Warrior Award they love to tout and give out every single year at the Hall of Fame, I think it's Matt Capitelli. WWE uploaded both nights of their United Kingdom Championship special from the Royal Albert Hall in the UK this past week. It had been taped the previous week, but they aired part one on Monday, which is now on demand on the network, and then part two on Tuesday. There was no William Regal there. For all the dignitaries that were there, Shawn Michaels and Triple H and Johnny Saint, there was no William Regal, and he has not been seen on NXT television also for probably at least a few months now. He's not been at any of the tapings in recent months. Apparently, he's out dealing with some sort of health issue, and so I hope it's not serious. But it's always surprising, you know, to see them go over to the UK and for him not to be there. You know, it's probably something at least somewhat serious, but hopefully not too serious. Mauro Ranallo and Nigel McGuinness had the call on commentary here on the show. Nigel you know, when Nigel was first brought in, he shined on that first UK special last year. It was him and Michael Cole, which I also thought that was some of the best work of Michael Cole's career. When he called that first UK tournament special on the network, he was great here too. Nigel was not surprisingly, they're in the UK. He knows a lot of these guys, which helps. Morrow is in his element when he's calling a show like this. They presented this as a lot more sports-like as opposed to, quote, WWE-like. Not that he can't call a WWE show. I mean, he's called plenty of WWE shows before, Morrow has. But you could tell, like, he's really most comfortable in this kind of environment. So I thought the presentation was great. The commentary was really good. Royal Albert Hall, it's just a beautiful venue. It reminds me of a bigger version of the Hammerstein Ballroom in New York. Just something about the look of it. And Hammerstein fits, I want to say 2,500 maybe. I don't know what the capacity is for Royal Albert Hall. I would imagine it's a little bit more. But it's just a beautiful venue. My only criticism here, and this really only applies to night two, or rather night one, I'm sorry, but I only wish they didn't darken the crowd so much. If you watch at least night one, they darken that whole building so much. And I know why they do it. They, you know, put the focus on the action and the talent in the ring. It's like a Broadway show, right, where they dim the lights when the performance starts. So I assume that's the reason why they do that. But the difference is with a play or a Broadway show, you're not broadcasting it from all angles. It's a little bit different. And on night one, I just kept thinking, man, I remember that first UK special in 1991 and how cool it looked, right? And it was all well lit and everything. And now they darken this thing almost like they just don't want you to see anything in the background. And to me, that just makes everything look the same. You need to take advantage of the uniqueness when you're in venues like this. And they did on night two. I'm wondering if they either realized it or somebody said something to them, because they clearly brought the lights up more on night two, and it just looked nicer. So, like I said, it's just a really nice, cool venue for a wrestling show. In the tournament itself, so they had a lot of tournament matches, all the remaining tournament matches on night one to determine the number one contender for Pete Dunne's UK title. That match would happen on night two. So this was my first time really seeing guys like Zach Gibson, Joe Coffey, Dave Mastiff, who is a very large man, Travis Banks. Flash Morgan Webster is the one who impressed me the most. If I had to pick one standout from the tournament for me, who was the most fun to watch, it would be him. I had a lot of fun watching him wrestle those middle two rounds. Somebody wrote into me saying it was kind of odd seeing Banks playing the underdog babyface, because they're so used to seeing him as a heel, which I guess he is in progress. Zach Gibson was clearly, he was the most hated man on this entire show from the moment he first stepped out. They told a story in the tournament with Joe Coffey injuring Travis Banks' shoulder in their match. Like a poor sport, when the match was over, he attacked him and posted him, and so that would play into Banks going into the finals. He was hurt going into that final match, which Zach Gibson won. He won the tournament. He earned himself a shot at Pete Dunne's championship the next night. With the heat that this guy gets, I mean, it would seem to me he would be positioned as probably the top heel on that new UK brand, because there certainly was nobody more, I think, reviled on this show than he was. But I didn't think any of the tournament matches were honestly a blow-away to me. I thought this was a step or two below that first UK special they did last year. Now, the finals was really good. It was the best match of the tournament. But again, I didn't think any of the matches in particular really stood out to me as like, wow, like, you know, match of the year caliber or anything like that. It was good, but I didn't think it was as good as the tournament they did last year. Toni Storm beat Isla Dawn and Killer Kelly on night one to earn herself a championship match with Shayna Baszler on night two. I love me some Toni Storm. She could be on the main roster right now and be one of the top, I'd say, three women on either Raw or SmackDown right now. And, you know, there's, I'm sure, a nice chunk of that WWE mainstream audience that doesn't know her, and she's very young, but I believe that if you dropped her, you know, like a drag and drop file, you just kind of plopped her onto Raw or plopped her onto SmackDown tomorrow, would not take very long. She would become one of the top three most popular female performers on that show. That's how good she is. I love the six-man tag, British Strong style, Pete Dunne, Tyler Bate, and Trent Seven beating Adam Cole, Kyle O'Reilly, and Roderick Strong. I thought that was the best thing on all of night one, even more than the finals. I enjoyed that match more. Tyler Bate is a very small man. We know this. but he is deceptively strong. I'm almost positive I've made this point before. I love that spot where he pulled off. It was a combination airplane spin, big swing combo. Pulled him off simultaneously with Kyle and with Roddy. And then Bate and Trent Seven pick up the win over Roderick Strong, which set up the NXT Tag Team Championship match the very next night. Shawn Michaels, he made a cameo appearance. He came out to do a little promo in the ring. He said he was terrified to have to follow that six-man tag team match, as well he should have been. He mentioned that he wrestled in this building in Royal Albert Hall way back in 1991, the first time WWE came there. Indeed, it was the opening match. It was him and Marty Jannetty against the Nasty Boys, and then Shawn came back out for the big battle royal later in the show. Triple H also made an appearance on night one. He came out to officially announce the new NXT UK brand. That is what they are calling it, NXT UK, not WWE UK. The UK champion obviously will be the centerpiece. They're going to have a women's champion. They're going to have a tag team or a set of tag team champions. He gave a list of dates where they're going to be taping television. I know we have a lot of UK listeners here, so if you are not aware of this, and maybe you want to try to get tickets to it, the dates they gave were July 28th and 29th in Cambridge, August 25th and 26th in Birmingham, October 13th and 14th in Plymouth, and November 24th and 25th in Liverpool. He also introduced Johnny Saint, which we already knew, but he physically, in the flesh, introduced Johnny Saint as the new general manager for the NXT UK brand. So, overall, a fairly eventful night one. Very good show. That led to night two, which was also eventful in that we have new NXT Tag Team Champions, Tyler Bate and Trent Seven, the team of Mustache Mountain. They beat the Undisputed Era to win the tag team titles. I wish I didn't have this spoiled for me beforehand, by WWE itself, no less. I can't blame this on any one person. There wasn't anybody in the Facebook group. It wasn't any one person on Twitter. It was WWE. They blasted out notifications to people's phones, spoiling the outcome of the match. Now, I'm smart enough, well, I'm not sure why some of you aren't, but I'm smart enough not to have those notifications enabled on my phone. I know people like breaking news and stuff like that, but I don't get the people who complain about the text alerts when WWE spoils stuff, because all you got to do is turn off notifications. I learned to do that a long time ago. But it wasn't even that. They tweeted something out, and I saw that by accident. And this was after the tapings. This was before the show even aired. So, like, you absolutely can argue, hey, once it airs, quote-unquote, like it airs, it's fair game, which it is. But to blast it out like that beforehand, I just don't see the need for that. You can be vague and say, hey, there was a big title change, right? Because night two had three championship matches. So if all you say is there was a big title change on night two, and you want to get people interested in watching it, you don't have to come right out and say that it was the tag team titles that changed. That's the thing that was confusing to me. I'm like, why would you do that? Like, it's like WWE is like that one friend who just cannot keep a secret. They just can't. They're also that one friend that always lets you down. And they're that one friend who bores the shit out of you with conversations that are about 2 hours longer than they need to be. But in any event, Trent Seven, he finished off Kyle O'Reilly with a burning hammer to win the titles. I thought that was a great way to open the show one night, too. Hot opener. UK crowd was hot as hell for everything they did. Noam Dar is back. He's been on the shelf with a knee injury for 6 months. He's back now. He won a fatal four-way he won over Flash Morgan Webster, Mark Andrews, and Travis Banks. That makes him the new number one contender now for the UK title. My boy Wolfgang, he was on this show. He got himself a North American Championship match with Adam Cole, who was over like a huge babyface here. Running knee strike by Cole finished him off to retain the title. I thought this was a good match. This was a good match. We had Aleister Black and Ricochet beating EC3 in the Velveteen Dream. Dream ended up bailing in the end on EC3. He has a tendency to do that sort of thing. That led to the finish, which was the Black Mass on EC3 for the win. Tony Storm and Shayna Baszler. I really like this match. Storm beat Baszler once before. They had a match in Japan a few years ago. Or maybe it was last year. I don't remember. I don't know exactly when it was, but I know that she has a win over Shayna in Japan. But she was not so lucky here. Baszler was very frustrated. Tony was, you know, the babyface coming back from underneath, kept making all these comebacks, and she even made the ropes in the choke. Baszler choked her on the outside. Tony got counted out. I didn't even mind it. honestly. You know, normally a count-out finish kind of gets a groan out of me, but in this case, they told a great story here with Tony just making the valiant babyface comeback and, you know, the desperate champion finally pulling it out in the end. And it wasn't like she choked her out in the middle of the ring or anything like that. This could easily be a women's title program on that main NXT show. I mean, forget the UK show. I think in NXT, Toni Storm can be, you know, having matches with Shayna Baszler for the championship. So Tony's great. She's only 22. Tyler Bate, you know, again, as good as he is, he's only 21. It's scary to think about how young some of these guys are and women and how good they can still be. Pete Dunne and Zach Gibson for the UK title. I thought this was excellent. Bitter end for the win to retain the championship. About 20 minutes the match went. Still very weird to see Pete Dunne playing babyface, but he's really not. I mean, if you think about it, it's not even fair for me to say that he's playing babyface. Think about this, right? What has changed about Pete Dunne? What has changed about what Pete Dunne does in his matches? Is he being nicer to his opponents? He's still grabbing their fingers and breaking them. He hasn't changed a thing about his character. He hasn't changed a thing about his moveset. Nothing. Nothing has changed. The people just have naturally, you know, started to cheer him and gravitate towards him. But he's such a natural prick. Like, he's so easy to hate. He can switch back at any moment. But again, he doesn't have to really do anything different except beat up somebody that people really like, and he'll be hated again. So here he was wrestling somebody from the UK that the UK fans clearly do not like in Zach Gibson. And, you know, somebody has to fill me in here. What did this guy do to get all of this hate? Because I'm not familiar with him. What has he done to get the level of hate that he had here on the show? Like, did he kick a puppy or something? Like, I need to know. But they had a great match. Really, this entire second day was lined up and down with great matches. Thumbs up. It's about 5 hours worth of content in total between the two parts. But I would say at least check out night two if you are not really maybe into the UK stuff and you haven't seen it yet. You're on the fence. Shouldn't I watch it? At least watch night two. I'm hoping that we get a UK match or two at the Brooklyn Takeover show next month. So fingers crossed for that. Maybe we'll get Toni Storm on that show. WWE made it official this past week as far as their new television deals that had been unconfirmed up to this point, but now it is confirmed that they are keeping Monday Night Raw on USA Network for the next, I believe, 5 years, for 3 hours. So unfortunately, Raw will still be 3 hours, which is very sad, but SmackDown is moving to Fox, and there's a lot of confusion, people saying, well, wait a minute, is it Fox or is it Fox Sports? I don't think people understand. It's the Fox Sports division of Fox. So this is falling under them. But the show will air on Fox. It will not be airing on Fox Sports 1, Fox Sports 2. It's airing on the main Fox network. We have a launch date now. The first episode of SmackDown on Fox will be October 4th, 2019. It is moving to Friday nights. It will be live, and it will, most importantly, be staying at 2 hours. And that's what I was worried about. I did not want them supersizing SmackDown just to match Raw. And I didn't think they would because, again, a lot of these Fox affiliates have a 10 o'clock newscast, and so thank God they're keeping SmackDown at 2 hours. But that is when they will officially be on Fox. Now, there were no monetary terms disclosed in any of the press releases that went out, but the SmackDown deal with Fox, it is said to be $1 billion over those 5 years, and the belief is that there will be additional programming, WWE programming, on FS1. Because they're going to want to boost that channel as well. And it may include a studio show, kind of like the UFC Tonight Show. That sounds an awful lot like a great spot to bring back Talking Smack with Renee Young, so hopefully they do. There's another rumor, which is unconfirmed right now, and I've only seen Ryan Satin at Pro Wrestling Sheet mention this, and he said he heard it from a source, but it's not confirmed, which is that NXT may possibly be moving to FS1 next year as well. Or at least there have been discussions in that direction. If that happens, obviously that would be huge for the NXT brand if that were to happen because it opens them up to a wider audience. But I also wonder this. I wonder, you know, if NXT moves to a cable network, a major network, I would think that it would make it a lot less likely that some of these guys are going to move up to the main roster as quickly as they otherwise might. So some guys go to NXT and they stay there for a year, 2 years. I think Sami Zayn was there for like 3 years. And then you have people like Kevin Owens, and I'm sure I could come up with some other names, who spend maybe a few months, 6 months maybe at the most, in NXT before they move on. It really just depends on what need they have to fill on the main roster as far as who they call up and when. But would them moving to FS1 make it less likely that people like Aleister Black and Ricochet would move up to Raw or SmackDown as quickly as they otherwise might? That would be my question, right? Because if they go to FS1, they're going to have to build their own core base of stars. You don't want to just gut them every couple of months. So I don't know. I don't know that they're going to want to move people up as quickly if that happens, but we'll see. Right now, this is all just speculation, but the TV deals are not. They are official. And again, October 4th next year is when SmackDown moves to Fox. The other story this week, and this is unbelievable. So ESPN broke this story, and I'll read part of it here to you right now. This is from ESPN.com. It concerns Vince McMahon and the XFL. We haven't heard about the XFL for a while. Ever since the first announcement, things sort of died down. And he kind of got shown up in a way by Dick Ebersol's kid, who's starting his own football league, and now they're going to be competing, I guess. But this was the story on ESPN. Vince McMahon's commitment to his relaunched football league is significantly larger than originally expected. The WWE chairman, who began funding the league by selling approximately $100 million in WWE stock. And yeah, by the way, what an idiot he looks like now, huh, for doing that. Because if he would have held on to that stock... The stock, last I checked, it was like well over $70. So I don't have the numbers as far as how much more he could have cashed out and made off that stock had he just waited a few months. But he probably is looking at that going, damn, if I would have just held out a little bit longer, because he sold a lot of shares of that WWE stock. And that stock, ever since the TV news started bubbling up, has been climbing and climbing and climbing. And now, like I said, the other day, I saw the after hours... they have like the aftermarket trading numbers, and the stock at one point was like at $77 a share. It was definitely not $77 when Vince cashed out, I could tell you that. But anyway, the belief was that he was only going to be putting about the $100 million in, which is a lot of money as it is. And he was going to use that to fund at least the initial operations for the XFL. Well, now the story here on ESPN.com says that he expects to spend closer to $500 million in the league's first three seasons. That's just for the first three seasons, if it makes it that far. First three seasons, $500 million. The CEO of the XFL is this guy named Oliver Luck. He talked to ESPN. He said the biggest cost is going to be salaries to pay the players and coaches. He said the average salary for the 40-man roster is going to be around $75,000, with players who are more in demand obviously making a lot more than that. And the other significant cost is insurance to cover player injuries. And he didn't say how much coverage the league will have, but he did say that the insurance premiums will come to more than $10 million a year. And I see a lot of people, you know, bashing this. And of course, they're talking about, well, you know, it would be nice if Vince can pay his talent or offer insurance to his own talent. And, you know, he's putting all this money into what will very likely be another failed football experiment. Okay. And I mean, Vince, for all of his failures, he's also had a lot of successes. And so look, maybe in 3 years, we look back on this and I'm eating my words, but Vince McMahon does not have a lot of success when he is dealing with things or working in a sandbox that has nothing to do with wrestling. That's just the fact. I mean, we've talked about this before. A bodybuilding federation, the first XFL, you know, they had the restaurant in Times Square. There's probably one or two other examples that you can come up with. And they've all failed. You know, and even the failures that he's had in wrestling, right? He's had failures in wrestling too, but he's had way more success. You know, the WWE Network. Maybe the numbers aren't quite where they would have hoped they'd be by now, but I would say the network has been a rousing success overall. But again, that's a wrestling project. So that's a WWE project. Anytime he peeks his head out of his own sandbox and tries to do something else, he fails. So I think people are well within their right to think that this is going to be another failure, but we'll see. But again, people are saying, oh, you know, it'd be nice if he took that money and put it towards, you know, WWE talent. And it is interesting to note, though, that, you know, his own performers in WWE don't get health insurance through the company. They don't get a 401k. They don't get a pension. There's no retirement plan. And them not offering insurance is fine if these guys were truly independent contractors, but of course they're not. Even though they classify them as such, they're not. by definition. They're not independent contractors. So we can get into that whole debate. I've talked about this before and what a farce that is. But all the people complaining and bashing Vince for this, they're missing the point here. This $500 million is coming from Vince McMahon's personal fortune. He can do whatever he wants with it. It's his money. It's not company money. It's his money. You know, if he wants to flush it all down the toilet, he's well within his rights to do so. If he wants to make little origami birds out of all those dollar bills and launch them off a building, he can do that. I mean, it's not like he hasn't wasted his money on failed experiments before. He spent $100 million of his own money to finance two failed Senate bids for his wife. Still, I love that because one of the greatest things still to this day that I've ever seen. After she, and what a failure. I mean, those two Senate runs for Linda McMahon, she just failed. And after she lost, I think the final time, she's up on stage giving a thank you address to all of her supporters. She's just been defeated. And Vince McMahon is on stage with her, but he's not like right behind her. He's not right beside her. You would think, oh, it's her husband. He'd be right there. He's on stage, but he's like all the way in the back. There's so many people. He's like in the back. It's like trying to find Waldo. And like, it's almost like he doesn't want anybody to see him, right? It's like the Hall of Fame every year. He stays in the back. He doesn't want to come out and be seen. Only once, I think, when he inducted Steve Austin, did he come out. But just as Linda McMahon is on stage giving her speech and shouting him out and thanking her husband, I'd like to thank my husband, Vince. The camera pans out just in time. You catch Vince rolling his eyes. He's like, as soon as she says that, he just rolls his eyes. It is the most hilarious thing. And he has this look on his face the entire time as she's speaking. Like somebody who realizes, oh shit, I just lost $100 million on this. So the point is, like, he's made a lot more money than he's lost, I would think, over the course of his life. If he wants to lose some more of it, more power to him. But just people have to remember here, it's his money this time. And that's the biggest difference. Last time the XFL failed, that was a $30 million loss for WWE. It was a WWE-NBC partnership. And so the company lost money. That was money that was really pulled out of the company that they lost. This time, it's all on him, so he can do whatever he wants with it. Raw last Monday night, there was no Twitter poll. I fell asleep right before the main event. For all the people who tweeted me, if there's ever a time where there is no Raw poll, either I'm away or I fell asleep. Right? They were like, it's like 24 hours later, and they're like, no Raw poll? Can you put the Raw poll up? I'm like, there's a reason I call them Insta-polls. They either go up instantly or they don't. They're not meant to be posted the next day. But I did go back and I watched the main event on Monday night, and I'm very happy I did. That was a great, great match. But as far as the rest of the show goes, there was no tribute video for Vader. We got a graphic at the top of the show. We got no tribute video for Big Van Vader here on this show. It was online. They put it on their YouTube channel. They put it on WWE.com. In a three-hour show, they did not have time to air this video. New Japan Pro Wrestling held a ceremony at one of their shows, the start of one of their shows this past week. Their new president came out for his big ceremony in honor of Vader. And here in this country, they couldn't even air a video for this guy on a three-hour show. As big of a name as he was no scrub. Vader was a big-time star, maybe more so outside WWE, but even in WWE. He was a big name. He was a top guy for a time. And they've worked with him in recent years. It's not like there was some sort of acrimonious relationship there. I mean, he was on a Table for Three special that they did on the network. He had been on Raw a couple times for cameos in recent years. Raw 1000, they brought him in to Vader bomb, you know, Heath Slater. And they just could not find time to air this, what was probably a 2 or 3 minute video. It's just, it's pathetic. I thought that was really, really pathetic. The story on this show, this is the storyline they're going with, and it is a storyline. Kurt Angle, who had previously announced that there was going to be a multi-man match at Extreme Rules, 5 or 6 guys, to determine a number one contender for Brock Lesnar's championship at SummerSlam. So this was announced the week before. Well, plans have changed. And the storyline is that because Brock Lesnar is backing out of his commitment, I guess his commitment being to defend his championship at SummerSlam, that Kurt has canceled the multi-man match for Extreme Rules. There is no longer going to be a multiple-man match. And, you know, it's a shame our champion continues to disappoint us. And I see these latest reports online credited. I've seen them credited to PW Insider and to The Observer, both of which are reliable sources. PW Insider in particular, you know, they break a lot of news. And so I've seen reports credited to both of them that Brock Lesnar will, in fact, not be at SummerSlam this year. He is not, as of now, on the card or in the plans for SummerSlam. Reason being, he's got one date left, supposedly, on his contract with WWE. They realize that they're going to be in Brooklyn and that the fans are going to eat Roman Reigns alive in that match. They're going to eat him up worse than they did for WrestleMania. You thought WrestleMania was bad, it's going to be 10 times worse in Brooklyn. And allegedly, Vince McMahon does not want that kind of reaction for Roman Reigns. He still wants the people to look to him as some sort of sympathetic figure, because here he is, full-time, busting his ass, making his shots, and the story is that Brock Lesnar doesn't want to come to work. That is now the storyline surrounding their Universal Champion. He does not want to come to work. He never shows up. And I'm still sitting here, and as reliable as PW Insider and all those sites can be, I'm just sitting here flabbergasted that a lot of you actually think that Brock Lesnar will not be at SummerSlam this year. I don't believe that for a second. It is nonsense. Do I have to sing it for you? Here, let me cue that. I'll sing it for you. I'll cue this up here. It's a work, 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 work. Can't you see that? It's a work, 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 work. All right, there. Are you happy? I don't know what else I could do. I could sing it. I can shout it. By the way, I am available for bar mitzvahs and other parties if anybody is interested. But of course he's going to be there. Of course he'll be there. And whether it's Roman Reigns or whether it's Braun Strowman cashing in, they have to get that championship off this guy once and for all at SummerSlam. And if this were real, and your champion, right, the man that you pay millions of dollars to each year for half a dozen dates or whatever it is, if he doesn't want to come to work, or if it's a storyline, and your big story is that your champion doesn't want to come to work, either way, you strip that guy of the championship and you kick him out the door. They are not hosting their second biggest show of the year with this guy still under contract in a major market like New York, and leaving Brock Lesnar off the show. You know, come on, people. Come on. So, we'll see where the story goes on television and how late it is before they finally announce that Brock will be there. But Brock Lesnar will be at SummerSlam. Maybe he's not on the schedule right now. Maybe there's a schedule that people have seen and Brock's name isn't on it, and you know, people in the company are told that he's not going to be there. I don't doubt that that may be true. Wouldn't be the first time that the company has lied to people. Or maybe they're not lying, and maybe right now he's not scheduled. I'm saying that in the end, he will be. And I'm kind of shocked that there are that many people who think he won't be there. So we had Roman Reigns and Bobby Lashley. They were in the ring with Kurt Angle at the beginning of the show when Kurt made this announcement about Brock and, you know, canceling the multi-man match, and they're still very clearly building towards a singles match for Extreme Rules with Roman Reigns and Bobby Lashley. Maybe that ends up being a number one contenders match. Well, I mean, I would think that's the logical direction that they seem to be going in here. But they were, you know, jaw-jacking back and forth. And they scripted this line for Roman, where he said something about how, you know, he was doing the MMA thing, but basically, like, he didn't do very well, or how'd that work out for you? It was something, you know, he was being very dismissive of Bobby Lashley's MMA exploits. And so I tweeted out, I looked up, I knew he had like a pretty solid record, and I looked it up, and he's 15-2. Now granted, some of those guys were scrubs. You could even say a lot of them were, but not all of them. I mean, there were at least a couple of legit fighters in there. And frankly, you know, when you have that many fights and you build a 15-2 record, I don't really care who you're facing. That's impressive. You know, CM Punk went up against two guys that you could argue were scrubbish, and he didn't fare too well. So it's not like just anybody can go in there, oh, it's so easy to win an MMA fight. Yeah, you try it. So I saw 15-2 and I posted a tweet. I said, hey, you know, somebody should let Roman Reigns know that Bobby Lashley is actually 15-2 in his MMA career. So I'd actually say he did pretty well for himself. So that's all I posted, right? Tongue in cheek. It's all part of the storyline, I know. It's not like, you know, Roman is obviously not scripting his own lines, right? It was a very innocuous tweet, I thought. But that didn't stop the Roman Reigns fanboys and fangirls from attacking in full force. And if you're a Roman Reigns fan, that's fine. Like RJ, if you're listening, I love you. This is not addressed to you or anybody else, okay? Who happens to really like Roman Reigns, right? I don't hate Roman Reigns. I mean, I could say that I'm sick of him being in this whole universal title deal with Brock, and I'd like to see them move on from it and do something else. That's far from hating somebody. There are people who hate Roman Reigns. Okay, they do exist. But if you are a Roman Reigns fan, I have no problem with that. But there are people out there, and I saw this after Money in the Bank with Alexa Bliss, where people were being attacked for saying things about Alexa Bliss, and the Alexa fan force went after them. These fanatics that you see on social media, and I know you've seen them. They are scary. I mean, I used to go through this with all the TNA fanboys back in the day. Had some fun with them. But, I mean, they're terrifying. Some of these people are terrifying. You've all seen them. These fan accounts. Like, these people are their heroes. They hang on to their every word. They follow them. Everything they post. Everything they do. They have a comment for it. If Alexa Bliss posted some kind of a rebuttal, right, on her page, you would see the comments underneath, yes, queen, slay them, drag them, queen. I mean, like, these people are demented. But I post that tweet and I mention Roman and the creatures that come out. One guy, I think it's a guy, I mean, you can never be sure, they never actually use a photo of themselves. But this guy tweets back at me and he just goes, Lashley was never a draw in MMA. And I'm like looking at this, I'm staring at this, and then I look and I see, you know, Roman Reigns Mania for me. That's the name of the person who said this to me. Roman Reigns Mania for me. Roman Reigns Mania. You have the words Roman Reigns Mania in your username. Whatever argument you make is automatically invalid. Then we have this winner. This is the other name I jotted down here. Sue Childress, or Childress, however the hell you pronounce it, right? Sue says, now, and remember, all I did was post Lashley's MMA record. That is literally all I did. I posted the man's MMA record, and Sue writes me, and she goes, big deal. And she said that with 3 exclamation points, because I guess 2 wasn't enough. Big deal. MMA and WWE, 2 different venues, so Bob needs to step off for real. And then 3 more exclamation points. And I'm just looking at this and I'm like, oh my God. Oh my God. The shit that I have to put up with on social media. It's bad enough I have to delete 16 different threads in the Facebook group showing Charlotte's bare ass. I have to read this nonsense too. She says, Bob needs to step off. I click on her profile. She's got Roman Reigns in her banner photo. Of course she does. It's like, I'm looking at it, I'm like, oh my God. There's a great quote, I don't know who said it, but it's like, never argue with stupid people. They'll drag you down to their level and beat you with experience. So true. It is so true. Authors of Pain have reemerged. I may have to turn that into a weekly segment, by the way. The, you know, fan fanatic of the week. They all come. That's why I don't tweet as much during Raw anymore. I mean, first of all, the show, I just can't get into it. But besides that, it's like, you know, the creatures come out. You know, Undertaker used to have his creatures of the night. The creatures come out. And I can't put up with it. But maybe if we talk about it more here on the show, maybe that could be fun. Authors of Pain have reemerged. They killed 2 jobbers. Hopefully it won't be 3 months before we see them again. And then we had, finally, some storyline advancement with Sasha Banks and Bayley. There was somebody who was very upset I didn't talk about them last week. They had 4 different segments on the show 2 weeks ago, this would have been. And I didn't talk about them at all on last week's show. And I, as I said to this person, I said, well, when they give me a reason to talk about them, I will. Because I don't care if they have 17 segments on the show. Nothing ever seems to change in this storyline. I mean, look, I am a fan of long-term booking and long-term storylines. But we hit this sort of almost like a dead end in this thing where there was no advancement at all. And then there was even a period where they weren't even really interacting at all. And it looked like maybe they dropped the whole thing, which you got to be, look, you got to be fair here. It's that wouldn't be the first time WWE dropped a storyline in, you know, in the middle of it. So it was easy to sit here and think, well, are they even doing this anymore? I mean, are they feuding them? And whatever interest I had had in seeing them feud was sort of, you know, was sort of gone. So then this week, they were forced, Bayley and Sasha were, once again, forced by Kurt Angle to team up. Kurt Angle, I mean, he's got it out for these two women. Putting them together, even though they don't want to team up together. But they were teaming up against the Riot Squad. It was actually Bayley, Sasha, and Ember Moon on this show against the Riot Squad. And Sasha ate the fall. There were, you know, there were more issues between them, and Sasha Banks lost the match for her team. And as soon as Ruby Riott picks up the win and gets this pin on Sasha Banks, Bayley jumps back into the ring. She had been on the outside. She jumps right back into the ring, doesn't waste any time, and just attacks Sasha. And the place went crazy. People are going nuts. And it got my attention. So she's beating the crap out of her, and then Bayley stands up, and she's sort of just staring at Sasha. She goes back over to her, starts kicking her in the corner. And then she goes to leave, and she's like, I'm not finished with you. And she pulls Sasha, violently yanks her out of the ring, and throws her into the steel ring step. She's beating the crap out of this woman. And people are cheering this. And then Bayley leans over, and she's talking trash to Sasha. You know, you did this to me. And she basically, and they bleeped this out. They edited this on television, but I guess on the Spanish version of the show, it was unedited, so somebody uploaded the clip. As Bayley is leaning down, yelling at Sasha, she basically said to her, you ain't shit. Yeah, you ain't shit, she said to Sasha Banks. And it was funny, too, because Bayley has that very, you know, childlike, happy music. And this was a pretty, like, by Bayley standards, I mean, this was a pretty heavy angle here that she just beat the hell out of her best friend and has this mean face and she just cussed at her. And then Bayley's music hits. It was like it didn't fit. You know what I mean? Like, if they ever do turn her heel, she's going to need new music for sure. But this was not... But the thing about this is, like, I love this. I thought this was great. I've been waiting for this for a very long time. I question whether or not they can sustain this, because you got to remember a few things here. First of all, the last time... We are heading into Extreme Rules. And the last time I remember Bayley being in an Extreme Rules match was that... kendo stick on a pole match that she had with Alexa Bliss, where she was too afraid to use the stick and she got her ass kicked. Now, I want to think that this is a real attitude change for the character, a new direction for the character, but then immediately after this, Kurt Angle goes to both of them and says that he's ordering them to seek counseling. And if either one of them refused, he'll fire them. He tells Sasha, you know, later on, he came to her and said, you need to go to counseling or you're fired. And I hear counseling and I think, well, that means we're getting comedy this week. So I am reserving judgment on this until I see what they do tomorrow night. You know, I got a kick out of those Dr. Shelby segments with Daniel Bryan and Kane like a lot of people did back in the day. But again, I don't know that it's necessarily appropriate here, because they did a serious beatdown angle on Monday that got people's attention. And now, again, they're threatening comedy. And so let's wait and see what happens. But I am skeptical. I am skeptical of what they may do. But for the people wondering, oh, Bayley turned heel. Did she turn heel? I didn't look at this at all as a heel turn. Because Bayley wasn't... she was kind of remorseful when it was over. And she was apologizing to Kurt. She was kind of like, I don't know what got into me. You know, if she was a heel, she wouldn't be saying things like that. She'd be getting up in Kurt Angle's face. She'd be talking about Sasha and calling her a bitch or all this other stuff. And she really wasn't doing that. So I think they're playing it up as Bayley just finally snapped. She's tired of it. She snapped. And she just lost her composure. And it won't happen again. That's not a heel turn. So I don't think there can really be any debate about this. I didn't look at this as a heel turn at all. Especially because she was cheered throughout the entire thing. So I don't see how you can really look at this as a heel turn. But then again, I guess Steve Austin was cheered at WrestleMania when he beat the piss out of The Rock with a chair. And that was supposed to be a heel turn. But they were in Texas. And so, yeah, you weren't going to get people to boo Stone Cold in Texas. But in any event, let's see what happens tomorrow night. I'm just happy they finally moved this thing along. It did something fun. You know, it was fun to see Bayley beat the shit out of Sasha Banks. I figured it would have been the other way around. It was nice for her to finally show some fire and get the kind of reaction she got. Because Bayley has been dead in the water now for so long. She comes out, she gets barely any reaction anymore. To see the crowd go crazy for this was actually really fun to see. They did a very unique, I guess, tag team match where they matched up Kevin Owens and Braun Strowman, the heel and the babyface, against heel and the babyface, Finn Balor and Baron Corbin. It was sort of like a miniature version of that old wild card match they did that one year in 95 at Survivor Series. I remember we're Gorilla Monsoon, we're mixing everybody up, and we're going to pair good guys with bad guys and bad guys with good guys. So that was kind of interesting, I guess, here. And Balor and Corbin didn't exactly get along well. They brawled at the back. Strowman and Owens ended up getting the win. And Owens was trying to get a handshake out of Braun, and he was getting a mean look. And so Owens just jetted up the ramp. He just ran as fast as he possibly could. And then what happened is that I guess Strowman forgot his briefcase. He went back, got his briefcase, and then he chased Owens to the back. And so eventually Owens grabs his shit. He's trying to go to the valet, give him my car keys, I gotta get out of here. And Strowman is standing off to the side. He's waving the keys around. He's holding the keys in his hand. It's like in the first Scream movie. When was it Neve Campbell or was it Courtney Cox? I think it was Courtney Cox. He was trying to get away. Tried to start the engine in the car. Couldn't find the keys. And Ghostface taps on the window and sort of jiggles the keys. That's what that kind of reminded me of. And he goes, "I hope you have insurance on your car." And Kevin looks over and he sees the car has been overturned. What an asshole. Really, what did Kevin Owens do to him? Like, I'm with Owens on this. Owens didn't do anything wrong. He's trying to befriend this guy. He wants to be friends with him. He didn't do anything to turn on him in their match or betray them. And this guy wrecks his car. What an asshole. And he laughs, too. Strowman laughs as he walks off. So I felt sympathy. I felt bad for Kevin Owens here. So, anyway, I assume that that's two more matches for Extreme Rules right there. We're going to get Constable Corbin against Finn Balor and Kevin Owens against Braun Strowman. The advertising a couple weeks ago was showing a cage match with Strowman and Owens, so I assume that's the direction they're going to end up going in there. Dolph Ziggler. Let's talk very quickly here about Dolph Ziggler. The latest Dolph Ziggler contract rumor is that he has not signed a new deal, and his current deal with WWE is set to expire later this summer. And so that is supposedly why they put the Intercontinental Championship on him. These Ziggler contract rumors, by the way, these Ziggler contract stories are becoming an annual game, sort of like whether or not is Undertaker going to come back for one more match at WrestleMania. Actually, this year, there is no doubt that Undertaker is coming back. He's wrestled a few times this year. He's wrestling again in Australia in a few months. And so there's no doubt that Undertaker is wrestling at least one more time at WrestleMania next year. But with Ziggler and all these contract rumors, if you believe every one of the rumors that have sprouted up over the months about Dolph Ziggler's contract, the man has three contracts at this point worth about $4 million. So good for him. He must be doing something right. Ziggler himself, though, batted down what Justin Barrasso of Sports Illustrated had reported a few months ago, which is that Ziggler had re-signed with the company for $1.5 million. In April, Ziggler denied this. He came out and flat out said, "I've not re-signed with the company. I wish I had for $1.5 million, but I haven't." Ziggler is in pole position right now. He can either hold out and re-sign for more money, or he can walk. And he could probably headline All In 2 next year, right? If they run a second one, which I'm sure they will. Or he can go and hook up with Bullet Club in New Japan or be a top star, really, in any independent promotion. because he brings with him a certain name value from being in WWE. He's a great wrestler. People, I think, feel, and he may feel this way too, people feel like he never really got a fair shake. He could have been, you know, a much bigger star than he was. So he can go anywhere he wants and be a champion, be a featured star, and probably, you know, become very popular. And look, it worked for Cody. It worked for some other people that left the company. Drew McIntyre, who has since come back. So Ziggler's really in a good position right now, if you think about it. Right? I mean, I don't think he's going anywhere, because if he had any appetite at all to try his hand outside WWE, he would have done it years ago. I think he likes it there. I think he's comfortable there. I think the money is really good. And I think for the time being, at least, he's in a featured role on TV, at least until he splits with McIntyre. Because this pairing, believe me, this pairing does not exist to get Dolph Ziggler hot again. It exists for McIntyre ultimately to be the breakout star. That's the whole reason for this pairing. But right now, Dolph Ziggler is the IC champion. He is the top de facto champion on Monday Night Raw, and he just headlined an episode of Raw. So this is as good as it's going to get for him. But he went out there with Seth Rollins. They had their rematch for the Intercontinental Championship. It went almost half an hour, they gave these guys. And of course, you know, McIntyre was involving himself early on. He ended up getting booted. So he was sent to the back. The match continued. There were a lot, I mean, so many near falls here. The crowd was into it every step of the way. I really can't say enough good things about this match. It was one of the best TV matches all year in WWE. Marred, I guess you can say, by a bad finish. But, you know, again, was it a bad finish? I mean, I guess it was a kind of a lame finish, but it didn't really bother me too much, because I did not expect the title change here. I expected that they were going to build to another match at Extreme Rules. And so I assume that's what's going to happen here. But the finish came when Rollins had hit the superplex Falcon Arrow combo on Ziggler. Referee went to cover, and the camera caught McIntyre coming out, which I don't think it was supposed to, so it kind of spoiled that he was on his way down. But he ran down just in time to yank the referee out of the ring. He went in, and ref called for the DQ. They beat down Rollins until Roman Reigns made the save. He speared Dolph on the outside. He gave McIntyre a Superman punch, knocked him out of the ring. And it would seem that we are in line for a tag team match on TV this week. Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns against Dolph Ziggler and Drew McIntyre. I guess we'll see. But this was great. This is a great main event to cap off what was otherwise, not, I wouldn't call it a great show. I mean, really, to me, the standouts were the main event and Bayley beating the crap out of Sasha. To me, those were the two big things coming out of the show. There was a note in this week's Observer newsletter that Vice TV, I guess Viceland, I think, is their channel. It said Vice TV. I can only assume that means Viceland. Is going to be airing a series of pro wrestling documentaries starting October 19th. There are 10 of them in total. And among them will, some of the topics anyway that they will be covering include Gino Hernandez, I guess the life and death of Gino Hernandez, as well as Dino Bravo, the Von Erichs, and Bruiser Brody. And that was all the information that was in there. I haven't been able to find anything else about this, but I think that that's really cool because those are some really interesting subjects. I know there was already a Brody documentary that people apparently said was really good. I haven't seen it yet. But these are all subjects I find fascinating, especially in terms of someone like a Gino Hernandez or a Dino Bravo, the way they died. And Gino Hernandez is often talked about. Michael Hayes has talked about him as being somebody who would have gone on to superstardom. I mean, he would have been a big, big star and had his life snuffed out very early on, overdosed on cocaine. There is some speculation that maybe there was a little more to it than that, which is why I find these stories so fascinating. And Vice has done some really good documentaries before. They're really good. So I'm really looking forward to these. And what the other ones are. I don't know what the other documentaries are. Those are only some of them. But the other thing I thought of when I read this was, this is the sort of thing that WWE really dropped the ball with. Because this is the sort of content that they should have taken the lead on with the network. And they do great documentaries. Those WWE 24 specials are really, really good. But they're primarily focused on those within the company. The Hardys came back, so they did a Hardy special. Kurt Angle came back, so they did a Kurt Angle special. They have the Women's Revolution, so they focus on the women within their own company. And that's great. And I understand them. They want to use the network as a tool to promote their own talent and to promote their own brand. They should absolutely do that. But they also, whether it's WWE 24 or WWE Expose, come up with whatever name you want to for it. They have a lot of non-WWE content and non-wrestling stuff on that network. They could have easily taken the lead on doing specials like this. Like, honest looks at different stories that are tied to the wrestling business, whether or not they tie in with WWE. And they can, and I know it's not the most glamorous subject matter, and a lot of it they probably want to stay away from where it concerns sex and drugs and murder and things of that nature, but that's what people find so fascinating, right? They could have really taken the lead on this and had documentaries like this on their own network. And instead, you have ESPN and HBO and Vice doing documentaries when this should be WWE's specialty on their own network. They should be doing a special on Gino Hernandez. They should be doing a special on Bruiser Brody. Even though Bruiser Brody wasn't a WWE guy, it doesn't matter. They shouldn't be worried then. If they can objectively cover these stories, especially, I mean, the Bruiser Brody story doesn't reflect poorly on them. It absolutely reflects poorly on the wrestling industry when you read up on what happened that night and how Brody could have lived had people actually gotten up off their ass and tried to help him. I mean, some people did, a lot of people didn't. That's a very frustrating story to hear. And again, one of the reasons I'm looking forward to seeing it retold here, it's a tough story to hear. But the Bruiser Brody thing has always pissed me off. Just the way that all went down, the guy was laying on the floor 40 minutes bleeding out. Like, that just never should have happened. But I think WWE should have been the ones to take the lead on specials and documentaries like this. And, you know, it's their loss. I guess in some cases they're just too gutless to cover some of the content. And in other situations, I guess they just don't think that there's an appeal, you know, to their audience. I think they're wrong. I think there would be an appeal. Jordan in the Facebook group wanted me to use this for a sad tweet. Even though it's not a tweet, it's actually an old WWE post on their Facebook page that somebody dug up from 10 years ago, and it did not age well. So included, it's hard for me to even sort of describe this, but what was included here is a photo of a Molina corkscrew bottle opener. Now, I don't think it's not a real item, I don't think. I can't be sure. I should say that I cannot be sure, because this is the same company that makes John Cena garden gnomes, for fuck's sake, so anything is possible. But I think it's just a gag. It was a photo of Molina doing a split behind a corkscrew bottle opener. So it kind of makes it look like a corkscrew bottle opener with a Molina top, you know, as she's doing a split. But the description that they included with this item is just something else. And this is from WWE. Allow me to read this. This was posted in January 2nd, 2008. The Molina bottle throttle. Does a stuffy party need some livening up? Whip out this stainless steel WWE screw job. Simply fasten Molina to a bottle of Chateau Mouton Rothschild. Twist her top and the diva will reward you with a revealing split. Now lower her legs into a more ladylike position and pop. Just keep some brawny handy in case you mess yourself. Oh, well, hey, it was a different time. It feels like a lifetime ago. But it was a different time. What can I say? SmackDown Live this past week. I did get a poll up. I did not fall asleep during SmackDown. 1,700 votes. 74% thumbs up. Only 26% thumbs down. So you guys seem to like this show. Shinsuke Nakamura. Let's talk about Shinsuke. Shinsuke was bitten by a police dog. That sounds like a kayfabe news story, but it's not. The day before, he was backstage at a live event. He was in the gym working out. The police were doing a sweep of the building. They had their canine team with them, and one of the dogs, for whatever reason, bit Nakamura on the leg. Maybe it's a racist dog? Who knows? But it bit Nakamura. Nakamura, I can assure you, did not have a bomb strapped to him. I don't believe he had any drugs on him at the time, or he would have heard about it. So, I don't know why the dog bit him, but the dog bit him. And the Bakersfield Police Department released the following statement. They said, on Monday, June 25th, officers of the Bakersfield PD Explosive Ordnance Disposal Team were conducting a protective sweep of the what is the I was going to say RoboBank. I think it's RoboBank Arena, I think is the name of it, in preparation for the SmackDown, or rather the WWE Live Summer Heatwave Tour. So, that's right. This would have been this was a house show. This was not backstage at SmackDown. During the sweep, the EOD team, which consisted of an explosive detection trained canine team and bomb technicians, entered an area of the building where an employee of WWE was present. Well, he's an independent contractor. He's not an employee, you see. The canine entered the room to sweep for the presence of any explosive material. As the sweep took place, the WWE employee was accidentally bit by the canine. The employee sustained an injury to his lower left leg. Medical aid was immediately summoned to the scene, and the employee was transported to a local area hospital for medical treatment. Don't they know that he was transported to a local medical facility? Can't these people get anything right? I hope Nakamura sues the shit out of this police department. If that were me, if I got bit by a police dog, you bet your ass that there would be hell to pay. So I hope he sues the shit out of them. They had a live event in Tokyo this week. Nakamura could not wrestle. So talk about bad timing. They just so happen to have two dates in Japan this week. He was going to be in the main event, challenging for the championship. He was one of the featured attractions on the show. Shinsuke Nakamura, back in the land of the rising sun. And he couldn't wrestle. He was not cleared to wrestle. He came out on a crutch. He cut a promo. He was, talking to the crowd. Samoa Joe came up. He got choked out by Samoa Joe on the first night. Samoa Joe took his place against AJ Styles. The next night, Nakamura, again, not cleared to wrestle on that show either. But the fans got a triple threat match instead for the WWE Championship with AJ Styles, Samoa Joe, and Daniel Bryan. And that, to me, sounds like a hell of a main event for SummerSlam. I'm just saying. So, anyway. Yeah, I hear that. I hear AJ and Joe and Brian in a triple threat. I'm thinking, Brock who? Brock who? I don't know who that is. But Nakamura also missed SmackDown on Tuesday. He was supposed to be challenging Jeff Hardy for the United States Championship. Instead, Jeff did the very tired open challenge gimmick. I'll cut them some slack here because they were kind of caught off guard by this. And it was accepted by Eric Young of Sanity. There was one truly awful twist of fate attempt early in the match by Hardy that was botched, and Eric Young sold for it anyway. It looked just comically bad. Just, you know, when you end up selling something like that, it just makes it look so much worse. It's like Lars Sullivan at TakeOver, right? When they show the Black Mask kick that is about 6 inches away from his head. And he has that delayed reaction where he has to sell for it. I mean, come on. You know, these are supposed to be professionals here. Come on, you can't be doing that. So, the match, botch aside, the match was fine. It was what it was. It degenerated into a brawl. The Usos came out. They were brawling with the other members of Sanity. And so it turned into a six-man tag. Jeff Hardy and the Usos against Sanity. Jeff Hardy and the Usos defeated Sanity. Sanity now suffers their first loss. This was only their second appearance, I believe, and they've already lost. But that's, look, I mean, that's what happens when you don't do the jobber thing, where you bring in a new act and you put them up against job guys for 6 weeks, or 2 months, or whatever it is, to kind of get them over and show off their moveset, and you just throw them into a United States Championship match, and a six-man tag against three of the more established stars on the brand. Well, that's what happens. You know, as long as you don't make a habit out of it. If Sanity goes on a win streak, then it doesn't matter. But if this is the first of many losses, then Sanity is going to be dead in the water here on the show. One loss will not kill them, though. Becky Lynch, she beat Sonya Deville with the disarmer. One of the low-key stories, I say low-key because I don't really see a lot of people talking about this. So one of the low-key stories on SmackDown right now, Becky Lynch keeps winning. And it makes me think that they may be going with an idea that I pitched here on the podcast a few months ago, which would have her go on something of a hot streak after all of the losing that she was doing. And it would be Becky Lynch challenging for the Women's Championship at SummerSlam. Not Charlotte, not Asuka. It would be Becky getting her moment at SummerSlam. And it looks to me like that may be exactly what's happening here. In the last few weeks, Becky has now gotten wins over Billie Kay, Peyton Royce, and Charlotte. And going back even further, she beat Mandy Rose and Sonya Deville in a triple threat match to qualify for the Money in the Bank match. So, I mean, her loss at Money in the Bank aside, she's been on a much better streak, a much hotter streak than she has been in quite some time. There was a tweet that was posted by the Lucha blog account that somebody had sent me a link to, where they had tracked all of the appearances for Andrade Cien Almas on SmackDown since debuting, or actually going back to even when he was first drafted. So he was drafted to SmackDown back on April 17th, and for the next 3 weeks, he had no match on the show. And his first match on SmackDown was on May 15th, and he had another match the following week on May 22nd. Since that time, he has had no match. Over a month now, no match for Andrade Cien Almas on SmackDown. They have the, as they did on this show, the little social media inset promos, or not even inset promos, the little, you know, the handheld promos that they do now, and it's Zelina Vega, really, cutting the promo. It's not even Almas. He just sort of stands there and looks mean. And I saw people were, you know, in some cases being very critical of SmackDown and Road Dogg, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're already ruining Almas. How are they not featuring him? And I'm going to cut them some slack here, because I assume that the reason for that, the last time we saw him doing anything meaningful, he had beaten up Sin Cara. And Sin Cara is hurt. He's out at the moment. And I think what they're probably doing is, I mean, he got injured, and they're probably just, because they just started a program between the two of them, they're just waiting for him to come back. I have to assume it's not a serious injury where he's going to be out for months. So I think they're just biding their time. I mean, there's so many potential great matches to have with this guy on this show. I would rather they hold him out and do nothing with him until they actually have a plan, rather than just put him on the show with no direction. And, you know, whatever. When Sin Cara is healed up, it'll be a, you know, probably a good match, an easy win, you know, for him. But then they could do Almas and Jeff Hardy, you know, for the U.S. title. Unless Nakamura beats him for it first. But they could do Almas and Hardy, whether it's for the championship or not. Almas and Daniel Bryan, if Bryan sticks around long enough. That could be eventually a big match. Almas and AJ Styles. You know, he's not going to be challenging for the WWE title right away. But again, these are matches that in the coming months, I think, are pretty exciting. I mean, if you followed his career in NXT, and even before NXT, the guy is great, and he found a winning formula, the combo with him and Vega, you know, some of the matches he had in NXT, namely, you know, the match with Johnny Gargano earlier this year, which I think is the best NXT match I've ever seen. There's a lot of potential there, so I'm fine with holding him out until, you know, Sin Cara, whoever is ready to come back, if they have a plan to, you know, have Almas go over on him, and then hopefully enter into his first big match. I mean, I'm kind of hoping that by SummerSlam time, he has a pretty good match, you know, on the card, you know, at a pretty decent level. I think a United States Championship match with Jeff Hardy could easily be the way to go if they don't end up putting that title on Nakamura, because I don't know what else Nakamura would do. I look at that SummerSlam card right now, and there is no SummerSlam card, but I'm just looking ahead, and I'm saying, you know, Andrade Cien Almas and Jeff Hardy for the U.S. title sounds good to me. AJ Styles defending the WWE Championship against Samoa Joe. If not Samoa Joe and Daniel Bryan, awesome. Although I think Joe and Styles one-on-one would be just as well. You can do Bryan and Nakamura. We still don't know if Bryan is re-signing with the company and sticking around. I think he is. As far as we know, he's still, you know, on his way out unless he signs a new contract. So that could play a role in his role on the card as well. But there you go, right there. That's, I mean, you could do AJ and Joe. You could do Bryan and Nakamura, who have been dying to wrestle each other. And this may be their only shot if he ends up leaving. And you could do Almas and Jeff Hardy for the U.S. title. That's three matches right off the top of my head right there for the SmackDown brand at SummerSlam. You know, and that's not counting anything with the tag team titles or anything of that nature. So, yeah, hopefully they have something good in store for Almas. James Ellsworth came out and complained about Asuka ruining Carmella's celebration last week and, You know, he said, last week I wasn't ready for Asuka, but tonight I am. And he took his shirt off and crowd chanted, put your shirt back on. Paige came out, said, look, you know Asuka's not here tonight. That's why you're coming out here and you're grandstanding. And she said, look, Carmella's going to defend her championship at Extreme Rules against Asuka. And Ellsworth then turns to Paige. He goes, look, the real reason you're here, we all know the real reason you're here. You want to ask me out on a date. So Paige plays along and she goes, you know what? You're right. In fact, I think we should have our date next Tuesday. And she said, but it's actually a match against Asuka. So the only match announced for SmackDown this week is Asuka against James Ellsworth. I'd be very disappointed if he doesn't bring his multicolored intergender championship belt that he bought and paid for. Of course, they don't do intergender wrestling in WWE, so this is all just an angle. I doubt there's any actual match, although I shouldn't say that. I mean, they could start the match and Asuka could beat him up and maybe, you know, they've got to work it smartly because they can't do what they would have done 15, 20 years ago. That's just not what they do. So we're not going to actually get a full-blown match. I would be curious to see that. I think, you know, if they do a full-blown match, it could be actually pretty entertaining, but we'll see what this angle leads to on Wednesday. We had Daniel Bryan and Luke Harper one-on-one in the main event. Harper went for a discus lariat. Bryan, though, countered that into a yes lock, and Eric Rowan jumped in for the DQ before Harper could tap. So now Bryan is getting ganged up on here, 2-on-1, and all of a sudden the pyro hits, and out, or maybe the pyro didn't hit. Maybe it was only the music, because they're too cheap for pyro these days, but out comes Kane. Mayor Kane, soon to be Mayor Kane, comes out, and it was great, because somebody uploaded an image. I don't know if it was from SmackDown, or this may have been from a few months ago. This actually, I don't think this was from Tuesday, but Kane is in the ring and there's somebody in like the first few rows with like two signs that they put together that said, like, don't you have mayor things to go do? I'm watching him walking down to the ring. I'm like, yeah, shouldn't you be getting ready? You've got kind of a big job ahead of you here. You know, maybe this is just a one-off, you know, they're going to do one tag team match at Extreme Rules and then he'll disappear again. But otherwise, I would think he has more important things to worry about right now. So Kane comes out, he gets a great reception. It's like, you know, you turn back the hands of time for at least one night when this guy comes back. I mean, I've lost track of how many returns Kane has had over the years. Kane and Undertaker and I guess Big Show to a lesser extent have to be the top three in this company. Undertaker's got to be number one. Kane has got to be pulling up the rear, though, at number two. For as long as he has been in this company for and as many returns as he has had. Now, Undertaker, you know, he left and would come back because he would get hurt all the time. He would tear muscles and he would suffer all sorts of injuries and groin pulls. I don't know that with Kane, it's different because Kane, by and large, and it's pretty impressive, you know, for as long as he's been around and he's a bigger guy, you would think, oh, he's got knee problems and stuff. Kane is rarely out because he's injured. Only one time do I remember him. He tore like a tricep or a bicep and he came back. That was the night at Madison Square Garden where he came back to beat up the Un-Americans. He did a spin-a-rooney. I remember that was a major injury, the first like real major injury of his career that kept him out for a while. But I don't hear about Kane suffering injuries. It's just sort of, you know, I don't know. I guess storyline purposes or whatever, he leaves, he comes back. But he has had so many returns over the years, and it's such an easy pop. Because if he's gone for any like extended period of time, people will always cheer for these guys when they come back because they're big and they come in there and they choke slam people and they kick ass. And then by about a week or two later, they don't care. And I suspect that it would be the same case here, other than the fact that Daniel Bryan is so beloved that if they want to do this Team Hell No thing for a while, I think they could probably do it for, you know, a while. I'd rather not see it. I mean, the thing is, like, you know, look, Kane came out here. He made the save. Okay, he helped Bryan, they laid out the Bludgeon Brothers, and I thought this might happen. I said as much last week. Crowd here, they broke into these loud chants of Team Hell No and hug it out. Kane extended his arms out for a giant hug. Bryan shook his head no, went to go leave, had a change of heart, and he hugged Kane. Massive pop, huge yes chants. People went nuts for this. Paige came out. She said that the Bludgeon Brothers will defend their tag team titles against Kane and Daniel Bryan at Extreme Rules. I was never a big fan of the whole Team Hell No thing when they did it the first time. I got a kick out of the Dr. Shelby skits. I thought they were entertaining, but that was about it. It made for a nice moment here at the end of the show. I think it'll be, for one pay-per-view, it's fine. There's nothing wrong. It gives, and I said this last week, that they bring Kane back, is what I thought they might do. And maybe what it is, it's something for him to do at Extreme Rules, because he's sort of in this weird thing right now where I don't know any obvious direction for him going into SummerSlam for a big singles match, unless they were going to build maybe something with him and Shinsuke Nakamura, which I think is what I would do. That way, like I said before, you can have your championship match, big match between Bryan and Nakamura underneath that, maybe Hardy and Almas for the U.S. title under that. You have your, you know, story with Becky Lynch going for the championship against Carmella, so the women are taken care of as far as that goes. Like, you know, and SmackDown could have a pretty solid lineup for SummerSlam. What I don't want to see is, and I don't care how popular they are, what I don't want to see is this extend out beyond Extreme Rules, where they look at this and go, oh, it's working again. Let's, you know, the Team Hell No reunion. It's like, let's keep this going. Let's just keep this going and beat this thing to death until it's just totally dead and dried up. And I don't want to see that, because I don't want to see Daniel Bryan teaming with Kane at SummerSlam. And I sure as hell don't want to see Daniel Bryan wrestling Kane at SummerSlam. Because if there's one thing I've learned about Kane, this fucker can't be trusted. And I would not put this past them at all, that in the end, Kane turns on Daniel Bryan. And if we end up with a Kane and Daniel Bryan match here in 2018, after the garbage we got with them in 2014, and it wasn't good then, and it wouldn't be good now. If we get that, I just throw my hands up in the air and I just say, I don't know what these people are thinking. I really don't. So that's the only danger here. This is not a one-off, and this extends longer than it needs to extend. Daniel Bryan should be in a featured match at SummerSlam. Him against Kane, to me, is not a featured match. It's old hat. And I don't know anybody who's clamoring to see that. So please, for the love of God, don't drag this out through SummerSlam. Leo Rush made his debut, in-ring debut, on 205 Live. He wrestled Dewey James. Short match. I thought Leo looked great. He's got the whole arrogant young millennial thing down cold. I thought that frog splash was very impressive. Reminded me of RVD from the late 90s or early 2000s. Even his promo after the match, you know, talking about how the other guys in the back are good, but they're no Leo Rush. I thought he came across great here. I think 205 Live is the perfect fit for him. Topanga from Boy Meets World, Danielle Fishel, came to visit him. She was there live to watch his very first match on the main roster, and she took a picture with him at the PWG show last year. I'm sure a lot of you saw that photo, and now here she is. She's followed him all the way on his journey to WWE. She's like one of those obsessed Twitter fans I mentioned earlier. And I should go check her Twitter. Maybe she's got a picture of Leo Rush in her banner photo. But what a week, right? Topanga comes to SmackDown to watch Leo on 205 Live. We have Kevin Owens getting to meet Shania Twain at her concert. She even took him up on stage. Good for them. See, celebrities are people too.
I'm actually not wearing pants, and that's how I watch NXT every single week.
NXT this past week opened with a segment with Aleister Black and Tommaso Ciampa coming out to interrupt him. And Ciampa's ready to put Johnny Gargano behind him. He beat him with both hands tied behind his back at TakeOver. He's finished with him. He wants to challenge for the NXT Championship. And this is exactly the direction that I pitched in my TakeOver Chicago review. I mean, it just makes sense to me. Ciampa gets the next shot in Brooklyn. He wins. And you eventually build to the third and final match, you know, with him and Johnny Gargano. I don't know if they could hold off until WrestleMania weekend next year. Or maybe they would do it in November. I would try to hold off on it for a while. But you know, do that match where Johnny beats him for the championship. Now, on the other hand, you could have Gargano cost him the title in Brooklyn. So Aleister Black retains. And he, you know, Ciampa is screwed over by Gargano. And that leads to sort of the third grudge match, the final match between the two of them. But I'm all in on a heel champion run in NXT for Tommaso Ciampa. climaxing with the Gargano match. I don't think... I've been disappointed by Aleister Black so far as champion. Not anything that he's done. It's more sort of what they haven't done with him. They haven't really done anything overly interesting with him. He hasn't had any outstanding matches that I can remember as the champion. And they put him with Lars Sullivan because, you know, we sometimes have to remind ourselves that NXT, at the end of the day, no matter what they say, is still a breeding ground. It is still a training ground for new talent. And they have a lot of high hopes for Lars Sullivan going forward, and so they need him working matches against people like Aleister Black. If he's ever going to get better, it's the only way. And I'd rather they do that. I'd rather they keep him in NXT and not rush him to the main roster and let him wrestle people like Ricochet and let him wrestle people like Adam Cole and Aleister Black, who actually know what they're doing and are pretty good at what they do. But, you know, in the meantime, because of that, coupled with the Gargano Ciampa feud taking center stage, two takeover specials in a row, where they headline the show, you know, and Aleister Black is sort of getting the Chris Jericho champion treatment in NXT. I can't even argue with it because Gargano and Ciampa should have been the main event. I don't have any issue with that. It was the most heated match on either of those shows. And unfortunately for Aleister Black, he is sort of, you know, one peg beneath them right now. So if they took the title off him, I wouldn't mind it. And frankly, I think you could call him up to the main roster. They're so stacked with talent, stacked. They're stocked and stacked with talent right now that you could take him after SummerSlam. Night after SummerSlam, you could debut him on Raw. Or you could debut him on SmackDown. And you'd still have Adam Cole and Ricochet and Velveteen Dream and, you know, a bunch of other people who could easily fill that void. EC3. We had Kona Reeves beating Max Humberto, if I'm pronouncing that right. Nigel McGuinness was mentioning on commentary that Kona Reeves has been getting advice from the Magnificent Morocco. There's a name I haven't heard on WWE television in ages. I don't know that I've heard his name mentioned since he did the induction at the Hall of Fame in 2004. He did the induction speech for... he was inducted that year. That's right. I think he was inducted... And I think the following year, I want to say, or maybe 2 years later, they brought him back to induct Mr. Fuji. And they talked about Fuji Vice and all that. Morocco should be talked about more often. Morocco was really good. He had his run as the IC champion back then. I mean, he was jacked to the gills, for God's sakes. I mean, you look at him in his later years in WWE, it's amazing he could even move. He was all muscled up. But, so, the first thing I thought when Nigel mentioned that was, what kind of advice exactly is this kid getting from Morocco? You better be careful with that. Obviously, he's not getting, you know, much in the way of training advice or, advice on how to bulk up one's physique. Because Kona Reeves needs a lot of work in that department. But, yeah, it was a basic match. You know, he hit the Hawaiian drop, which I still think is a terrible, shitty name for that move. And he needs to change that. He's a work in progress. I want him to succeed just so I can take credit for saying that he's going to be a big star one day, which I made that comment once. I said, there's something about this guy. And this was before he was doing the Playboy gimmick that he's doing now. He still had the short hair. He had like the crazy eyes. I don't know. There was something about him. I just thought to myself, he's going to be a star. I don't know how big, but he'll be a star. And the last few times I've seen him, I have seen no indication of that. But that doesn't mean that they don't see something in him, because he wouldn't be in NXT if they didn't see something in him. I'm just waiting for it to come out. But when he does become a star one day, I will happily take credit for it. Candice LeRae beat Lacey Evans. We don't see Candice LeRae wrestle very often. Hopefully this is the start of that. She's sort of been the wife in distress. But people forget she's a really good wrestler. And she beat Lacey Evans here. She had a huge lion saw. This wasn't just a lion saw. She got some height. Bouncing off the ropes on this lion salt, got the win. Johnny Gargano was backstage after this, and he had a very frenzied look on his face, like he has just been traumatized by that loss to Tommaso Ciampa takeover. He cannot believe that he lost to Ciampa. And he said, he did mention here that his favorite wrestler is his wife. Since they were coming out of her match, they asked him about it. He said, his favorite wrestler is Candice. My wife is my favorite wrestler. Bobby Heenan would vomit if he heard that line. This guy is whipped. He also wants one more match with Tommaso Ciampa. He cannot let this go. He cannot let this feud go. He said, I will fight him anywhere. I don't care where, when, parking lot. I'll fight him in the grocery store. And as soon as he said that, the light bulb went off in my head. I said, a grocery store brawl is exactly how this feud needs to end. I want to see that now. Now they're promising things that they can't deliver on. I would be totally down for that. You know what? Better yet, let them battle it out supermarket sweep style. They each get their own cart. They each have 60 seconds to fill their cart with as many items as they can. And the person with the highest total in groceries gets to pick the stipulation for their last match. At least it would be different. I had heard that they were rebooting that show. Supermarket Sweep was supposed to be coming back. Although now, with all of what they do these days, it would probably have some kind of reality show element to it. They would fuck it up somehow. But yeah, supposedly Supermarket Sweep is coming back. We were told that William Regal wants Johnny Gargano to move on to fresh opponents, and he signed a match for next week between Gargano and EC3. The next match was supposed to be Mustache Mountain, the new tag team champions, defending. They were supposed to wrestle, let me see if I got this right here, Dave Dixon and Carl Axelrod. I don't think Dave Dixon or Carl Axelrod have done anything to deserve a tag team championship match, so I don't believe this was supposed to be a title match. But we'll never know, because Undisputed Era came out, beat the hell out of them, threw them off stage. Literally threw them off the stage before they could even make their way down to the ring. Kyle O'Reilly called their win at the UK special a fluke, and Adam Cole said that they're going to win those belts back. You guys, we're not going to let you guys back on UK soil with those belts, but Ricochet came out, it turned into a six-man tag, so I guess Adam Cole was wrong, because there was no tag team title match here, but it turned into a six-man tag, Ricochet and Mustache Mountain against the Undisputed Era. This was great. This was a great match. Ricochet had it won. He hit the 630 on Adam Cole. Kyle O'Reilly made the save. He paid the price for it, though, when Ricochet wiped him out on a dive out to the floor. Roddy, he snuck up on Ricochet. He gave him a flipping suplex on the apron. That looked absolutely sickening. And he rolled him back inside. That allowed Adam Cole to get the pin. So they seem to be building to a North American Championship match between Ricochet and Adam Cole. Again, you look at TakeOver Brooklyn. Aleister Black against Tommaso Ciampa for the championship. Adam Cole defending the North American title against Ricochet. Shayna Baszler probably against Kairi Sane for the women's championship. I mean, I'm visualizing this in my head, having not read any of the spoilers for any of the TV that they did. But those are the matches that, you know, seem to be taking shape, or the most logical for them to do. Maybe they could do Candice LeRae against Shayna Baszler for the championship. Candice wins the title by fluke and Johnny snaps because his wife wins a championship, but not him. And then he just goes crazy. Lucha Underground, episode 3, here in season 4. Show opened with Johnny Mundo convening an emergency meeting of the Worldwide Underground in the locker room, and among them was Ricky Mundo. He is a member of Worldwide Underground. Ricky Mundo explained that those weird photos he got from Dario Cueto last season, which is sort of one of those little attentions to detail that I completely forgot about, but why I love this show so much. There was actually one of those little cutscenes that they did where I don't remember who had been just in Dario's office, but Ricky Mundo was either there also, or he walked in after the fact, and Dario had these photos that he was looking at, and he sort of just, I think he threw them in the waste paper basket, walked out, and Ricky looked in the trash bin and pulled them out himself. If I'm remembering that segment correctly, I think that's what happened. But he mentioned that those photos were of a real place in Mexico called the Island of the Dolls, which is where he got his creepy new doll Rosa from. He has named the doll Rosa. He pulls Rose's pull string in the back, and the doll says, "Hola," in this really high-pitched voice. Johnny talks about starting a war with a reptile tribe. He says, "Tonight, Jack Evans, you're going to call out the snake people." And Jack says, "Well, I hate snakes, and I have a colonic appointment," or a colonics appointment, and he walks off. So basically what that means is he's getting his colon cleansed. To be more specific, I looked up the definition of a colonics. appointment or a colonic. It's an infusion of water into the rectum by a colon therapist to cleanse and flush out the colon. Cannot imagine why anybody would want to be a colon therapist or what school you go to for that. But every damn day of my life, I'm constantly dealing with people who are full of shit. So I think I'd make a pretty good colon therapist myself. And if not, I can refer a few people to them. Anyway, when everybody leaves the room, Ricky stays behind with his evil, creepy doll. And the doll says, "Don't worry, Ricky, your secret is safe with me." And then it laughs maniacally. I won't sleep for weeks after watching this scene. I hate dolls. Those, like, not marionette. There's a name for them. I forgot what they call them. I hate those dolls. Those dolls are so creepy. But never tell a wrestling fan to stop playing with his dolls. They hate that. They're action figures. I've noticed people get very testy if you call them dolls. So if you ever want to really piss off a wrestling fan and they have wrestling action figures, you call them dolls. It's the easiest way to get under their skin. Jack Evans came out to battle a newcomer to the temple called Exolicious, who is a young 24-year-old kid doing an Exotico gimmick, very much like Pimpinella Escarlata, who we have not seen on Lucha Underground in a while. Yeah, very effeminate, dressed up in very effeminate gear, but he can wrestle. The kid can wrestle, and he won, too. He won with the top rope X-Factor, so that's something. Pentagon Dark, the Lucha Underground champion, got a jobber entrance here. They came out of break, and he was already in the ring. And he cut a short promo. He got blindsided by They Call Him Cage. Cage set up a table outside the ring. He took Pentagon out on the apron and powerbombed him through the table. So that sets up the next opponent for Pentagon. And then it was time for the first ever three-way to the grave. Triple threat, basically a triple threat version of Grave Consequences with Mil Muertes, Phoenix, and Jeremiah Crane. And before the match, Melissa Santos was in the back with Phoenix. Of course, they are in a relationship on camera, and she's very concerned about his safety. And the story here is that Katrina asked for this match so that Muertes could kill Phoenix, basically. She would kill, you know, he would die in this, I guess by going in the coffin, you're dead. So they would kill off Phoenix, and as a result, she could steal his life force because she's sort of caught between these two worlds, and I don't know. But she needs the life force, okay? So that's what Katrina needs, and all I can say is, sorry, Melissa, but your man has to die. So now you guys know my all-time favorite Lucha Underground match is the first Grave Consequences match from Season 1. It was Mil Muertes against Phoenix. That is still to this day my favorite Lucha Underground match, and it remains my favorite Lucha Underground match. This one was excellent, but that first one is still safe at number one on my list. But I just love the way they present these matches. The stipulation, the ominous music, the artwork on the caskets is very elaborate. It's not just a dull, empty, blank box. They have the Day of the Dead people who carry the coffins to the ring, and they carry the caskets to the back when somebody gets put into them. I just love all of it. You know, they just present it in a very unique way. And they have a tendency to do WWE matches better than WWE does. You know, they do it with casket matches. They do it with their Aztec Warfare matches, which are, you know, better than the Royal Rumbles that we've seen most years. You know, even that one time they did an all-night-long match, which is their version of an Iron Man match. It was one of the better Iron Man matches I had ever seen. I think it was the one between Rey Mysterio and... It was Prince Puma and Johnny Mundo. Is the one that I remember. So, I love that aspect of this. My favorite moment from this match was after they took out Mil Muertes in a table spot on the floor, the focus shifted to Jeremiah Crane and Phoenix, and they brawl up the staircase to the upper level. And Crane gives Phoenix a pile driver, right? So he lays him out. He gets up, and Jeremiah Crane is standing there, and right behind him are these two, like, elevator doors, and they open. Mil Muertes pries them open, and he's standing there. Out of nowhere. There he is, like something out of a horror movie. I love that. Phoenix ended up wiping both of them out with this insane dive off the balcony. It didn't take them very long to do a balcony spot here in the new building. Ivelisse made her big return after Crane had assaulted her with a hammer, if you remember, and broke her ankle at Ultima Lucha last season. This time she had a hammer in her hand, and she returned the favor. She broke it over his head. knocked him back into the casket and slammed the lid shut to eliminate him. So it came down to Phoenix and Mil Muertes, just like old times. Just like old times, he rips at Phoenix's mask and nearly rips the entire thing off. Busts him open on the exposed buckle. He's bleeding everywhere. Muertes loosens the bottom rope, yanks out that metal spike, right? That metal portion of it to use as a weapon. He is just beating this poor guy down, but no matter what he throws at him, Phoenix just keeps fighting back until he can't fight back anymore. He tried something off the top, he got caught with a flatliner, and he got stuffed into the casket, giving Mil Muertes the win. So now they're 1-1, because Phoenix won the first one, Mil Muertes won this time. Melissa Santos, she can barely get the words out, but she announces that Mil is the winner, and Katrina is happy because she no longer has to be stuck between worlds. Show ended with a shot of Matanza chained to the floor in the basement, chained there by his father, Antonio Cueto. Antonio has a giant black key. He claims it holds Matanza's soul. It was a gift from him from the gods when he gave Matanza up to them. He says it's made him weak. He tosses the key down to Matanza and tells him to destroy it if he wants to become a god. He does so, and all of a sudden he's able to break free from the chains, and Antonio says goodbye to his son, and that is how the show goes off the air. I have to say this. The crowd on this show is a lot more subdued than they usually are for these Lucha Underground shows. I noticed that a little bit last week also. It's just, something's off. I like the show. I'm enjoying it so far, but it ain't the same. Something is off. It's not the same as it was in the other building. I don't know if it's any one thing, but like I said, I still enjoy it, but I would say there's something a little bit off from previous seasons. Let's get to your mailbag questions. You can email me, thesolomonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I thought this was an appropriate question to use here up top since I got this from a few people. Brian from Baton Rouge, Louisiana. This week marks the 20th anniversary of the 1998 King of the Ring. I know that you have stated in the past that the 93 King of the Ring is your favorite, but what do you think about the 98 show? The 98 King of the Ring is probably my second favorite, actually, now that you mention that. And that's not because there were like a ton of great matches, but there was enough memorable stuff on that show where when I think back to it, I'd probably put that right behind 93 on my list. But Brian's right, past Thursday was the 20th anniversary of the night that The Undertaker tossed Mankind off the top of the Hell in a Cell. I still remember watching that live. I was watching it. My father was home, and so he was watching it as well. And when that spot happened, we were just stunned. And it was so early in the match, too. It wasn't even like it was building to some big climactic spot. Not even 5 minutes in, 3 minutes in, boom, the guy's dead. It just came out of nowhere. As I'm sure he literally came out of nowhere. If you were one of the Spanish announcers down below, this guy just came out of nowhere. But I just watched the match again. Because I knew it was pointed out to me that it was the 20th anniversary. I said, you know, I haven't watched the match in full. You know, from start to finish, I haven't watched it in years. So I went back and I watched it. And the thing about this match is there is a feeling of excitement after he gets tossed off the cell, right around the time that he goes to climb back up. There is a certain excitement because, A, it's like nothing I've ever seen before, and B, I don't know what's going to happen next. I had no idea what was going to happen. How do you top that? You've thrown somebody off the top of the cell. What can you possibly do to top that? And they're going back up. And that was the thing. That, to me, is one of the great moments of that match. Is when Foley shrugs off the doctors and the referees and Terry Funk. And he has a separated shoulder. His shoulder is legit fucked. And he is climbing back up the cell. Undertaker had started to climb down on the opposite side. He had to sort of hold up a little bit. He was waiting for Foley to come back. So he's just sort of hanging out on the side of the cage. Undertaker's ankle is jacked because he had injured it. So his ankle is jacked. Foley's shoulder is jacked. Now they're climbing back up. You've got Jim Ross, the greatest of all time on commentary. This is his greatest, you know, performance as far as commentary goes. I mean, his commentary bits from this match are used in so many sports parodies and videos on YouTube, and it's just comical. Yeah, the way that I look at Bobby Heenan's commentary performance at the 92 Rumble as being his best, well, this was the best of Jim Ross. And Jim Ross has talked about the fact that he didn't like to really know what was going to happen in advance when it came to these matches. So him and King had no idea. They did not know that Foley was going to be coming off the top of the cage. They didn't know he was going through the cage. They didn't know anything. And JR got him his job. I mean, he got Foley a job in the company, so he was very close to Mick. I'm sure he was very emotional after he saw him go flying off the cage the first time. Now he's climbing back up, and you hear JR on comment, oh, he's going back up, you know, Mankind is going back up, and the fans are just, there's like buzzing in the crowd. It was exciting. It was scary, but it was exciting because you didn't know what was going to happen next. And I listened to the podcast, or part of the podcast that Conrad just did with Bruce Pritchard, talking about the 98 King of the Ring, and more specifically talking about this match. And I know Pritchard, you know, for all the stuff that's true, he also tells tall tales. He has his version of events. Yes, he was there. We weren't. But that's like saying on Eric Bischoff's podcast, well, Eric Bischoff was there and we weren't. So you have to take everything Eric Bischoff says for gospel. Eric Bischoff is a promoter who has his point of view on the way things were. And Eric Bischoff, I'm sure for all the truths that he tells, is also full of shit on a lot of other things. And Pritchard is no different. Pritchard has his version of events on things, but he also tends to sometimes talk about things where you listen to it and you go, that's not right. That doesn't sound... I'm not just talking about, like, wrong dates and stuff. Like, sometimes things are said that just make you sit there and go, this guy is full of shit. Or he's carrying the water for Vince McMahon still after all these years. So you get a mix. You get a mix of all those things. But I do believe him on this. He confirmed something that Mick Foley, I believe in his book, had always denied, which is that the second cell spot, after they climbed back up and Foley got chokeslammed through the cage, that was something that was planned in advance. And I know some of you may be listening to this going, well, isn't that obvious, Salamas? You're not really breaking any new news here. I thought it was obvious, but again, Foley himself and other people have always said, well, you know, the first spot was planned, but the second one, he wasn't supposed to go through. And I always used to hear that and go, you're full of shit. Mick Foley, I love you, but you're full of shit. Let's think about this logically. Mick Foley just got tossed off the roof of the cage. He then climbs back up onto the roof. There was no way he was coming back down in anything but a violent manner. They were not going to agree to disagree with one another, shake hands like gentlemen, and gently climb back down. They went back up there for a reason. That's number one. Number two, I get that Foley was all disoriented. He had, like I said, the dislocated shoulder, but he took one of the worst-looking chokeslams that you will ever see. It was more like a shove. It looked like Undertaker shoved him backwards, not like he chokeslammed him. And I've always watched that and thought, he was braced or bracing himself to go through the cage. Otherwise, it just comes off looking awful. And it seems like, if Pritchard is to be believed here, the truth may actually be somewhere in the middle, and maybe Foley was just sort of bending the truth and not really lying, per se. Pritchard says the plan was for Undertaker to chokeslam Foley on that panel three times. And each of the first two times, it would give a little bit more, and it would give a little bit more. And by the third one, hopefully, he says hopefully, because how do you even prepare for something? You hope it breaks on the third one, but they had no guarantee it was going to break on the third one. The hope was that by the third one, it would break. And I guess maybe Foley would like hang there. He wouldn't just go straight through, but the panel would break and Foley maybe would hang. But ultimately, he would fall. It just wouldn't be quite the same distance, and maybe the fall wouldn't be quite as violent, but he would fall from the top of the cage and he would land in the middle of the ring. If that's true, and that's the first I'm hearing of that, but if that's the case, Foley would not be lying if he said that the spot, as it happened, was not planned that way. But the insinuation that that wasn't a plan, that any kind of fall wasn't planned, which is how I always read it, I never bought that for a second. I thought, dude, come on. It's obvious that something was planned and you were going to go through the cage. I'm sure that I know the chair falling and hitting him in the face was absolutely not planned. That I believe. Foley's actually said the worst part of that bump wasn't even landing in the ring. It was the chair hitting him in the face on the way down. But they absolutely knew he was going through that roof in some form or fashion when they went back up there. You'll never be able to convince me otherwise. The rest of the match, I'm watching it again and I'm thinking to myself, I don't know how this guy was able to continue. And if that happened today, first of all, this match would never happen today. It would never happen. When Foley took the first bump off the cage, he was laying there for what felt like 60 seconds or 90 seconds before anybody even came over to check on him to make sure that he was alive and breathing. Because he was laying there prone. He was not moving. He could have been dead. Not one person came over to check on him. Jim Ross, legit on commentary, had to say, get off your butt in the back and get somebody out here. Because nobody was coming out. If that happened today, they have a doctor at ringside. People would be out there in 10 seconds. You know that Charles Robinson sprint to the ring at WrestleMania 24 in Orlando, where he came down to the ring like the Ultimate Warrior? That'd be him coming down to the ring now. That's the first biggest difference. A, that spot would never be okayed, and B, there'd be people on the spot to make sure this guy had a pulse. But then to let him go back up, and to go through again, and to let the match continue, it's just, it's unbelievable. Things have changed so much that it's jarring now to go back and watch a match like this and watch all of this happening and think, how is this ever allowed? How is this okay? I felt guilty watching this. Now, thank God, Foley seems to be okay. All things considered, Foley still has his faculties about him. He's a very bright, very articulate person, and he's going on tours, and he's being very active. But he's also, you know, he's still a relatively young guy. I'm still very worried about what Mick Foley is going to look like in 10 years. I think a lot of people are worried about that. I'm sure his own family is worried about that, but you try not to think about it because what's done is done, right? You can't undo the damage. You take risks. You weigh the pros and cons of those risks. Foley's career was one giant risk. And it paid off in that, you know, he became a big star and, you know, he's able to support his family and live a comfortable life. You worry, though, at what cost? You watch a match like this and you wonder how many years off his life. How many years came off his life from this one match? You know, and I look at this match and I think it's both one of the best and one of the worst matches in WWE history. I can't grade this match the way I would sort of grade other matches. Oh, it was a great match. It wasn't even a match. It was just a wild brawl. It's hard to judge a match like this. But I'm not going to lie and say it's not exciting to go back and watch all the chaos and everything. And it was a crazy fucking match. But it's also one of the worst matches that the company has ever had. Because you can't top that. And for years after that, I'm sure there were plenty of wrestlers in the company and young people wanting to grow up to be wrestlers who now are, who watched that and said, man, I'm going to have to top that one day. And who knows how many other crazy matches and crazy spots and injuries that match led to. So it just set the bar so high, and it was such a violent match. And Foley's a nice guy, and I don't know. I mean, just to see him put himself through that kind of abuse, it's sickening. It's like the 99 Rumble. It's hard for me to go back and watch the end of that match with him and The Rock. Knowing that The Rock held nothing back. He was waylaying him in the head 12 times with a chair. Guy's all bloody, his arms are tied behind his back, and Rock is not holding anything back. And he is just bashing this guy's brains in with a steel chair. It is uncomfortable to go back and watch stuff like that. And I'm somebody who kind of wishes that, you know, we had blood a little more often in matches and things weren't so buttoned up in PC. But even I have my limits, you know, and I go back and watch that and I'm like, I can't believe this happened. I cannot believe that this was allowed to happen. This company would be kicked off television if they did stuff like that now. It's just the way things have changed. Now, one thing I did learn listening to that Pritchard show, and this I was not aware of, I'm sure many of you remembered Francois Petit. Right, he was the guy who came out there with the ponytail to check on Foley. I thought he was a doctor. I don't think he was actually a doctor. He was a massage therapist. He was a physical therapist. But I had no idea, and I learned this on that show, that he played Sub-Zero in the first Mortal Kombat movie that came out back in 95. That's pretty wild. So I went up on IMDb. I said, I got to check this out for myself. And sure enough, I bring up his IMDb profile, and there he is, Francois Petit. He played Sub-Zero in the movie. And his IMDb bio is insane. I want to read this to you because this is just amazing. This guy sounds like an amazing person. It says, Francois is a world-class martial artist from a large family, all skilled in the martial arts. He began his training at age 3 under the guidance of Japanese masters and also studied at the opera. In 1971, he was drafted into the army in Africa where he was wounded. He became a prisoner of war for almost 6 months and was paralyzed. After his release, he spent 5 months in the VA hospital and doctors told him he would never walk again. But with his own strength and spirit, he recovered and became a great martial artist, stunt coordinator, and teacher. Francois worked as a trainer and physical therapist for the wrestlers of WWF and taught martial arts at Gold's Gym. In 2004, he moved to Korea to improve his skills. He later moved to Spain, where he still teaches martial arts. That is quite the life to live for Francois Petit. I was not aware of that. As far as the rest of the show goes, because it really, I mean, there was more than just one match on this King of the Ring show. I can remember watching the show and thinking Ken Shamrock and The Rock had a hell of a match in the finals of that tournament. I remember being disappointed that Shamrock never wore the cape and the crown, which looking back would have been ridiculous. And I'm actually happy that young Jason was not in a position to have booking power over WWE. Maybe today young Jason could actually do some good for WWE, some of the wild ideas he had back then. But yeah, so I think putting the crown and the robe on Shamrock, who came in as this serious mixed martial arts fighter, they call him the world's most dangerous man, that would have been probably about as smart as putting a blonde wig on Goldberg. I also remember the main event. Now think about this. Stone Cold and Kane had to come back out and follow the Hell in a Cell. They were immediately after that Hell in a Cell match. They had to follow those two guys. And they did, only because Austin was so freaking popular back then. He was, I mean, it was insane how over he was. So the crowd was hot for that entire match. But I remember the main event, Stone Cold had this huge wrap on his elbow. He had a staph infection. These days, we all have to deal with a staph infection. But, you know, Austin wrestled this match here with a staph infection in his arm. It was basically half first blood, half Hell in a Cell, because somebody lowered the cell halfway into it. And it's a memorable match because it's the one and only time Kane ever won the WWF title. He lost it the next night, which is the only reason they put the title on him in the first place. They wanted to pop a big number opposite Nitro, and it worked. They did like a 6.0 Nielsen rating or something like that, I remember. I used to clip out of the newspaper whenever like Raw would do a gigantic monster rating. The TV section of my local newspaper here, the Daily News, would have a little story on it. You know, when they got an 8.0 that one time in May of 99, there was an actual story on that in the newspaper, and I have those clippings every time they would pop a big number. But, so it worked. You know, their plan worked. Now, beyond the things I just mentioned, I have no recollection of anything else on this show. So, the Shamrock Rock Final, the Hell in a Cell, and the Austin Kane match with Kane winning the championship, those are the only things I remember from this show. I don't remember anything. Actually, that's not true. I remember Al Snow teaming with Head. I do remember that. Beyond that, I don't remember a thing. And what's crazier, if I can go back to the Hell in a Cell match one more time here, what's even crazier about that is for all the abuse that Mick Foley took, it gets forgotten that Foley came back out for the main event. He did a run-in in the championship match. And I would say it was maybe 2 weeks, two and a half, yeah, probably about 2 weeks. 2 weeks after this match that Foley had, 2 weeks after this pay-per-view, I got to meet Foley for the very first time. This was the live Raw at the Meadowlands in New Jersey that I won luxury box seats to for my local radio station. I know I've told that story before. Part of the deal was that they would send 4 wrestlers to each of the luxury boxes in the hour before the show went live on the air. So during all the dark matches, or maybe it was, I guess it still would have probably been like a Superstars taping back then, they were sending 4 wrestlers from box to box to have some private time for about 10-15 minutes with the people in the box. So during this hour, they sent Owen Hart, Mankind, Mark Henry, and Luna Vachon. They sent them to our box for autographs and for pictures. And I remember Owen and Mark Henry and Luna, they were all sort of standing around, mingling and signing stuff for people. Foley was sitting. He was sitting down. He was shooting the shit with Owen about talking about their kids and picking their kids up from school and all that kind of stuff as they were signing things. They really weren't even paying attention to us. They were signing, but they were just sort of engaged in this conversation with one another. And I just remember looking at Foley. He was all disheveled. He was wearing the Mankind outfit with the white shirt and everything. He had the mask off. And I'm looking at this guy and I'm thinking, you know, he just looked how just completely beaten to shit he looked. I remember thinking, man, this guy looks like he's seen some shit. And it wasn't hard to see that he was still very much reeling from the after effects of that Hell in a Cell match. It was only 2 weeks later. You know, and to see him up close like that was something I don't think I'm going to soon forget. And I don't think that's a match that anybody, if you saw it, will ever forget. And for a lot of reasons, I hope we never see another match like that again. Tay from DC. It's been 11 years since the Benoit murders. I wanted to ask you not about that, but if you think how wrestling and the coverage or perception of it has changed since that time. Have people distanced themselves from wrestling because of Benoit, or has time healed most, if not all, of those wounds? Well, I mean, you know what heals old wounds? Money. And WWE is rolling in it right now with those rights fees. They have been the beneficiary of a spending spree by these networks for TV rights for sports. And we've seen in recent years, even the embrace from ESPN, for the first time, WWE is being covered on SportsCenter. I remember being in high school thinking, man, it would be cool if one day WWE was covered on SportsCenter. D'Lo Brown did an interview in the WWF magazine once, and they asked him a question. I don't remember exactly what the question was, but I remember his answer. It might have been like things that you would like to see. And he said, I would love to see what we do covered on SportsCenter one day. Now it's commonplace. Who would have known? So the mainstream acceptance of wrestling is absolutely happening. It's been happening now for a few years. Now you have these TV rights fees that have exploded. They're going to get $1 billion for SmackDown, right? So I would say that the perception has changed a lot. NBC now has been able to get real sponsors for wrestling that they can never get on their own, car companies and companies that just did not want to have anything to do with WWE, that didn't want to have anything to do with the stain of wrestling. Now they're advertising on Monday Night Raw. So there was a period of time where I'm sure people wanted to steer clear of wrestling, and it had a stigma. It still has a stigma, but after the Benoit stuff, I mean, it really had a stigma. And that's pretty much all gone now. I don't think anybody, you know, certainly a non-wrestling fan, nobody really thinks about that. WWE, for all the things we could say about how they run their business and everything, they've done a very good job of cleaning up their image and portraying themselves as something more than just a wrestling company, whether it's all the philanthropy stuff they do or I mean, any of the other things in that vein that they do with Make-A-Wish and stuff like that, the stuff with the women. You look what we're doing with all of our women now. We're empowering our women. Like, they do all of these things. It's all about the brand. And it's working. Right? It's working. I don't hear anybody talking about, you know, Benoit or bra and panties and all the stuff they used to do back in the day. So I think they are fully accepted now in the mainstream. They are as successful now financially as they've ever been. We could talk about the creative aspect of the product, but yeah, I think a lot has changed. I don't really see too many people distancing themselves. I see more and more people getting into bed with WWE. So I think it's been 11 years since the Benoit stuff happened. That's a long time. People have short memories, and I don't think it really affects the company at all anymore. It did for a while, but not anymore. John from Middletown, Connecticut. I've heard you talk several times over the years about the original plan for Hulk Hogan to wrestle Ric Flair at WrestleMania 8. I remember WWE going so far as to actually announce the match on TV before changing plans. The story is often repeated that Flair and Hogan did disappointing house show business leading up to it, and that is why the match was scrapped. Well, I mean, if you listen to them tell it, they sold out everywhere they went. They were hanging from the rafters, if you listen to them tell it. Anyway, I always had a different problem with the proposed match. WWE had booked itself into a corner. and there was no good outcome. Flair was made out to be a big deal when he first came in. If Hogan beats him, it kills all of his momentum, and he goes back to being just another guy. If Flair wins, WWE is basically saying that the NWA's top guy was better than their own guy that they had built their business around for the last decade. The only out would be some kind of a double countout or DQ, but then you're left with a BS ending on your biggest show of the year. Looking back on it, how would you have booked the finish to Hogan Flair at WrestleMania 8? If Hogan is leaving after WrestleMania, which I think he would have been leaving no matter what, because the steroid stuff and the Arsenio Hall stuff, and they probably wanted him gone too, frankly. I think he wanted to go away for a while. He had some TV stuff. I don't know if this predates Thunder in Paradise. I think that maybe came later on, but Hogan was going to step away. If Hogan is going to step away, then you cannot put the championship on him anyway. So what I would do, honestly, I would have done a similar ending to what they ended up doing with Sid. Now, I wouldn't have had Papa Shango botch his entrance and that whole thing was all completely fucked, but I would have done a similar ending, but I would have used where you have a DQ of some kind, a non-finish, disappointing as that may be, but one that allows you to do two things. A, set up the next challenger for Ric Flair, so you can move on beyond Hogan without hurting Flair. And B, you have a non-finish in the very first match between Hogan and Flair. So this whole thing, like, who's the better man? Who's the better champion? We don't get an answer. And it sets up, it leaves the door open to an eventual rematch when Hogan is ready to come back, maybe at WrestleMania 9. So it leaves the door open for a rematch. Flair moves on. He can defend the championship against Savage. He can defend the championship against Warrior or Bret Hart or whoever else. And that's probably what I would have done. I would have wanted to keep the door open if I knew Hogan was leaving. Don't have a decisive winner. Do a non-finish. Do a DQ. You could have Warrior. Look, people didn't seem to mind too much that there was a DQ in the match. When Warrior came running out, they went nuts in the Hoosier Dome. People were a lot easier to please back then. So you could do the exact same finish where the Ultimate Warrior makes his big comeback and runs out and people go nuts and he lays everybody out and poses with Hogan. And I guess he would be set up as the next challenger for Flair. I don't know how those matches would have been. Probably not very good. But that's what I would have done. Let's see here. Steve from Virginia. Buy or sell? Buy or sell on a great 2-hour wrestling show or a good but not great 1-hour wrestling show? You know, it's getting harder and harder for me and for my attention span to tolerate even 2 hours, let alone 3, every single week. But I will buy on a great 2-hour show over a mediocre hour-long show. As long as the show keeps me engaged and it's exciting and it's fun, I would take that every week. Julian from Arizona, I'm watching Raw, the Raw Anthology on the network, and I'm on the year 1997. I watched an episode where Ken Shamrock called out Mike Tyson. Do you know why, and how come nothing ever came from it? That was something that WWE told Shamrock to do. He was on commentary, he called out Mike Tyson. I remember them promoting it like it was such a big thing. I think this would have been right before, maybe the month before he had his first match in the company. Shamrock against Vader. So part of it may have been that they just wanted him to look legit going into that match. But I think they also wanted to get Tyson in, obviously. I mean, they did get him in. It was a year later. But they probably wanted Tyson to say yes, even if they didn't expect him to. Unless, you know, and had that fight happened, my money would have been on, I mean, Ken Shamrock. I mean, unless Tyson clocked him in the face right away, all Shamrock had to do was take him down and Tyson probably would have been done for. Thomas from Fort Worth, buy or sell on who had the better hose, The Godfather or Hacksaw Jim Duggan? The Godfather. Of course, it's always The Godfather. How did we never get a segment with those two? They love doing comedy so much, I'm surprised we never had a segment with Godfather and Hacksaw Jim Duggan with their dueling hose. Anyway, we'll wrap it up there. This has been a long show this week. Keep emailing me your questions, thesolomonster @gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter. My handle on there is @solomonster. It is not @RomanReigns4Real or 4Mania or whatever the fuck. @solomonster is my handle. I promise you will not find any Roman Reigns photos on my Twitter page. I have my first physical therapy appointment tomorrow. Very exciting. Not. Yeah, I have that in the morning for my knee. I'm seeing another orthopedist this week. I'm going to take my MRI results. $35 it cost me to pay for the disc for these MRI results, as if it's not going to cost me enough. It's like insult to injury here. Pay us another $35 for my own test results. So I will be armed with them. I'm going to get a second opinion on Tuesday and see if they recommend I have surgery to take this glass out. I was going to leave it alone, but everybody's telling me, oh, that's not a good idea. Everybody went to medical school all of a sudden. So we'll see what the good doctor has to say. I'll keep you guys updated on that. In the meantime, it is July 4th coming up this week. It's on a Wednesday, which is kind of shitty, but we do have the holiday coming up in the next few days. I want to wish everybody a very happy and safe 4th of July, please. I always say, you know, be well, stay safe. And then you always hear about these firecracker accidents, people blowing off fingers and hands and stuff. If you're going to be around that stuff, if you're going to be, like, doing that stuff, just be careful. Because I want you to be able to push play on the podcast next week with your dominant hand, right? So you need your fingers and your hand intact to be able to do that. So just be safe. And I will see you guys back here for a brand new podcast next weekend. Time-wise, I don't know. There's a lot, some stuff I have to do. I actually have to be over at NBC next weekend on Sunday morning at like 6 a.m. So if anything changes as far as the schedule of when the show may or may not be out, follow me on Twitter. I'll let you guys know. Otherwise, I'll see you for episode 554 next weekend. Until then, take care, guys. Happy holiday.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Sala Monster sounds off.
They have Kane in the back. This is what he said. Tonight, I will delight as I enter the abyss with a fellow monster. But it is I who will climb out alone and with a smile across my face.
Oh, oh my God.
What do they think this is, Shakespeare? I was driving yesterday, and some asshole double parks his car in the service lane. I should have cut a promo the way the WWE would script one out for me. Why art thou parking like one's smelly orifice? I wish 1,000 deaths upon thee. Then I could do a fucking tope and we could fade to commercial.
Sala Monster sounds off.
Since 2007, the Sala Monster sounds off. Available at thesalamonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Sala Monster sound off.